Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Tuesday Night Jaw roundtable slash list edition on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Jim Smallman, and my guests, who I will introduce in a minute. Before I get to that, a couple of plugs. First of all, obviously check out everything on the Distraction Pieces Network because it's all gravy. It's not gravy, it's podcasts. But do check them out because they're all great. And also, Saturday, September the 9th at noon, there is a live Tuesday Night Jaw roundtable slash list slash challenge craziness edition at the London Podcast Festival at King's Place in London. So Saturday, September the 9th at noon. If you want to come along to that, you can get tickets through the link at jimsmallman.com/TNJ. jimsmallman.com/TNJ, Saturday, September the 9th, London Podcast Festival, the day before the sold-out Progress show at Alexandra Palace. So, you know, make a weekend of it. Maybe take in a show in the evening. Maybe go to the West End and take in Kinky Boots. I don't know what you go and watch. I need Glenn here to get musical theatre advice. But go and do, make a weekend of it. Or if you live in London, just make a normal weekend of it where you get on a tube, listen to a podcast, go home and then come back again and watch wrestling the next day. So Saturday, September the 9th, jimsmallman.com/TNJ. And as usual, if you want to tweet me your thoughts on this podcast that we're going to do in a second, I'll explain what the top 10 list is in a moment and the proper rules for it. If you want to be involved and tell us your list, then tweet me at jimsmallman. Maybe write your list out on your phone, in your notes, do a screenshot of it and then tweet it to me at Jim Smallman. Use the hashtag Tuesday Night Jaw. Right, guests who can also plug some things. Guest number one, it's his front room, kind of.
It's not my front room.
It's not your front room.
I'm a 41-year-old man who does not and never will own his own house, which I feel is getting in before it's cool, because that's going to be the case of every adult in the UK.
Yeah. Cheers, Teresa, if that is your real name. And I suspect it probably is.
Yeah, your mortgage went through okay, didn't it?
My mortgage did go through okay, yes.
Fuck yeah, this is Stevie Pugh's front room. And it's not as tidy as last time because Scroobius Pip isn't here.
No.
But, yeah, hello.
He's still got Scroobius Pip's outline of where he sat on the sofa before. Like, it's been preserved with starch.
It's like someone's been going over it again and again.
I love the fact that we've done this podcast so often that we're presuming that no one's a new listener and everyone knows Chris Brooker's voice. But that's Chris Brooker, everybody. He's my chum. He's a dude.
We go back years, man.
We do go back years. How long have we known each other? 10 years now, I reckon, at least.
Must be. I had loads of hair. You had some hair.
Thing is, you know when people... I get people tweeting me when they realise I'm a skinhead. People are like, oh, remember when Jim had hair? No. I've still got the same amount of hair, roughly, that I had about 10 years ago. My hair's been falling out for years. I just shaved my head now.
Oh, yeah, that's
to preserve the image in a kind of Mitchell Brothers kind of way.
You've basically gone... You've taken the bull by the horns. It now looks like choice.
Yeah.
Rather than the choices being forced upon you.
Yeah.
Because I think if you'd rocked a comb over, there's always scope. Just comb it back or...
I bet there's at least one hipster in London now who's going, do you know what? Now's the time for the comb-over, guys.
Do you know what? The ironic comb-over where they shave a bald bit.
Mm.
I mean, that's a fresh hell.
If someone wants to do that and come to a Progress show, do.
I can't take the piss. Mine's going on top. Did you spot the yours was going on top from a security camera?
Yes, it was. I was in
a
bank.
Yeah, security camera. I'll tell you, it's like, who's that bald for? Oh, God.
Yeah, I was in a bank. Oh no, I spotted it in a bank once and I just thought it was bad lighting. And then when I used to actually pay someone to cut my hair, you know when they do that thing where they show you the back of your head? I noticed every time I'd go and have my hair cut, they were taking less time at the back of their head showing me the... As if to go, if I show him this, he's going to think I fucking did it.
Yeah.
So that was the point. What? So yeah, anyone who feels like tweeting me, telling me, oh, you still have hair. Yeah, I know. I know. The reason people always use old publicity photos of me for gigs, because that's normally where it comes from. I'll tweet a picture, I'll tweet a gig poster, and people will be like, oh, you used to have hair. Yeah, I also used to have a lot less tattoos. I used to also be fatter. The reason that
you didn't look so tired either.
I didn't. The reason all comedy clubs use those is because, you may have noticed, all my publicity photos now include me covering my face with my hands because I don't like being photographed. So the only time I like being photographed is in a wrestling ring. So if you look at my cover photo on Twitter, is the back of me in front of a crowd at Brixton Academy. And my avatar is both the hands over my face. And the only way I'm going to get around this, I'm going to do a new hour-long show at the Leicester Comedy Festival next year that I'm going to call Not the Face. Because then I've got a reason to use a picture of me without my face in it. So I hate being photographed.
Somebody books comedy gigs. I hate you.
Yeah, no, thanks, man.
Quick plug.
Plug some stuff.
Plug quick. Future Shock Wrestling on August 25th. It's our 13th anniversary show. It is going to be spectacular. We are looking to sell it out. We've sold out ringside, nearly sold out second row. General admission are going the same way. Main event is Zach Gibson, Liverpool's number one, defending the Future Shock Championship against a man who's made Manchester his home, Ashton Smith.
Yeah.
So we'll see if he can do that. We've got Sonny Durson versus James Drake, April Davis versus Lionel Austin, and the first ever Adrenaline Rush Rumble match, which is nothing like anything that's ever happened before, especially in TNA.
Is it reverse power oil?
Yeah, it's already started. What we've done is we're making everyone travel in, and they're having to film themselves on megabuses.
Good Lord. Good Lord above.
What else? So at Future Shock Wrestling, futureshockwrestling.co.uk, at Future Shock Wrest. Yeah, that's it, really.
That's it. Nothing else to plug?
No.
Sweet.
I don't do anything.
Good. That's the future. The other guest is... how can I best build him up? I mean, I could give him some wheat, but that'd kill him.
There's a difference between building and bloating.
There is. There's a man who's not had a solid poo in quite some time. Matt Richards.
Hey.
No, it's not true. He sent me one in a Tupperware box the other day.
Hello, Matthew.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. Thanks for alerting the world to the fact... I mean, people don't know what... I mean, they'll know now from the description of the podcast, but no one knew what we were going to be talking about today, or indeed that there would be an edition of the three of us chatting together, because we've not done one for a bit, because I've been doing all these ones where I meet people.
Yeah.
But by telling the world that I'd ruined your evening by making you come up with a list.
No, I didn't. I didn't specify how and why.
Oh, no, I know. But the fact that you tagged me in on it, that I ruined your evening. So, I mean, it meant one of two things. It meant that I had either given you a list to formulate, or I had held you down and forced a baguette into your mouth.
Or made me cry again, which is the other one I got.
You made yourself cry, mate.
But to be fair, we're just at that point now where you can just ruin my evening just by being there.
Thanks, mate.
You know, that's a level of friendship that we're at now, mate.
It is.
It's just one text message. Oh, fucking hell. You know.
That prick again.
Yeah. Good. People genuinely think that this is like some sort of like character. I fucking hate lists. I really hate them. This is my least favourite thing in the world ever.
It's because he hates decisions.
I get so wound up by it, and I shouldn't. I know I shouldn't. Logical side of my brain's going, it's just a laugh, isn't it? And then irrational side of my brain's going, you must make the perfect list that has ever existed and not be questioned.
Now, this is an important thing, because it is a list episode. Do we have a bell?
A bell.
A bell.
A bell.
Yeah. No, it's just because it's a list thing. And obviously, I think me and you, Chris, I think our suggestions will probably be fairly reasonable. But every time he makes a fucking dickhead hipster suggestion for his list, can we just ring the bell?
I don't know.
Have we got any form of noisemaker that we could use
bell,
for this?
Do we?
We've got like an air horn.
Oh, man. Mine's out at the cleaners. What?
Yeah. We'll come up with something.
I mean, we'll just have an agreed noise.
I think this perception of me might mislead people, because my list is fairly sensible. Mm-hmm. There's a couple, again, you know, I dabble.
At least one wrestler you made yourself with Play-Doh.
Yeah, made on Tumblr and just made GIFs of it. And it's a real thing now. But yeah, no, I'm whatever. It's not like I've looked at this list for the last 12 hours and changed it a million times.
How long? So you've been looking at it for 12 hours?
No. Like, I slept okay last night. So like I got a decent night's sleep.
Are you sure you slept?
But the first thing I did when I was doing my emails and stuff this morning, and having a coffee, I was like, no, I need to look at that list again. And I changed at least 3 people on it. So
do you know how long I took on mine?
Like 10 minutes. Can you message me to say?
Yeah, 8 actually.
10 minutes.
Yeah,
10 minutes maximum.
Because you're old and you remember shit, and I don't.
Because I was busy writing a preface for a book, guys. That's what I was doing. Yeah. Because the internet made that happen last week.
Yeah, I know.
Soz, guys.
I know. It's not like you've got enough to be getting on.
Nah, I'm not busy enough. Right, so today's list is this. It's the top 10 wrestlers who have never worked for WWE. Now, there are some caveats here. Caveat number one, Christopher asked this question last night. You can have worked for WWWF when it was a territory, but ideally not have held one of their major titles, because that kind of makes you a part of their canon and their folklore. If you came in for a few matches and then moved on to another territory, that's kind of fine. That's kind of pre-1984, probably. You can have been in developmental before it was NXT if you never got called up. So you cannot have been in NXT. So, for example, one of the first names I put on my list was Sami Callihan, but he did appear on NXT, mm-hmm. So he is excluded from this, okay? So you cannot do that. If you had one or two dark matches in WWE, that is fine. You were not signed to a contract, you were an extra. That is completely and utterly fine. Were there any other rules I put in place?
I could only have 5 Japanese
You could only have, you could only have 5 Japanese
wrestlers.
So this wrestlers.
Is basically the Dragon Gate
right,
roster.
No. Hang on, let me double check. I think I've got 3, possibly 4. Let's have a look. Okay, so I have 4, but what I've done with the 4, I've gone with 3 that are a generational transition, so 80s, 90s, and noughties, mm-hmm. and then another one who eclipses everything. So I've got reasons behind them.
Okay, I'll be honest.
Also, do you know what's really, really bloody annoying about this list? Number one on my list was going to be Sting, because I was like, Sting in it. And then I remembered he had a WWE title match, didn't he?
Oh, and he wrestled at WrestleMania, and he's in the Hall of Fame. And
yeah.
You know.
Other people, I don't know if you've come across this, so other people that I lost out on was Terry Gordy, which I thought, oh, he'd be sick.
Executioner, mate.
Exactly.
Oh, man, I forgot about the Executioner.
Yeah. Jack Briscoe, because I was like, well, Jerry Briscoe's obviously worked there, but Jack Briscoe wrestled there apparently loads in the 80s when they bought the territory. And then I had a couple of others that I was like, oh, they're good, but I stopped myself because they were either too hipster or slightly too obscure.
So this is the other thing I've tried to do with my list, is there needs to be a reason. So if my top 10 list was just, here's a load of the, and in some cases, they are just people who are great wrestlers. Mm-hmm. But it can't just be that. WWE is a different, no pun intended, universe to most places that you will work. So you can be the single greatest worker on the planet in terms of appealing to guys like us or Meltzer or whoever. It doesn't necessarily mean you would be a star in WWE.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So in some cases, like, I had to exclude people for that reason. It'd be like, what about... Oh, no.
There's a reason why they didn't go there.
Yeah, and I think that... In most cases, I've tried to justify why they'd be in WWE. I think that's what you've got to do.
We've all found the game within a game, independently, one another.
And what we'll do is...
That's why we're friends.
We'll all do our number 10s first. Don't... If we happen to mention someone who's later on your list, mm-hmm. don't spoil it for later. You'll just be able to gloss over a bit more later on.
I mean, mine, I'll admit, is in no particular order.
And then you need to make it in a particular order.
Okay, I'm going to go top to the bottom of this list.
Boom, good times.
At this moment in time, I'd like to point out that at no point am I going to cry. So if you tuned in for this reason to hear me cry about something emotional...
You don't know who I've got on my list.
Oh, God.
Right, I'm going first. It's my podcast. I'm going first. Number 10 on my list of wrestlers who have never appeared in WWE. And also, if you want to be a smart ass and tell us that people did appear in WWE, then fine. But I'm fairly sure, laid out by our rules, it's fine. Okay? The odd appearance, uncontracted appearance is acceptable. Number 10, Dr. Wagner Jr.
Oh, so hipster.
It's not hipster. And there's a reason for this. One of the biggest stars over the last 2 decades in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Actually... is a big dude for a masked wrestler. So, you know, 5'10", 220 pounds, big dude. Great moveset. So, often my problem with Lucha is it's a little bit wooden break eggshells. Do you know what I mean? It's a little bit slow motion. It's one of the reasons I like Flamita so much, is everything Flamita does looks like it kills you. Everything Pentagon does looks like it kills you. That's kind of what I want out of my wrestling. I want stuff to look like it hurts. So in those cases, that's one of the reasons with Dr. White is all power bombs and suplexes and great stuff like that. Still wrestling now, he's 50 odd. But peak time would have been sort of late 80s, mid 90s, I think. Could have really done the job. The other thing is as well, and this is he's done stuff recently with Lucha Underground, which shows you what a star he is. You know, there was certainly a point where Vince was trying to appeal to the Hispanic community. I think Dr. Wagner could have been a big star from that point of view. Pre-Rey Mysterio. You know, they had that point in the mid-90s when they were using...
Was it Super Astros or something?
Yeah, but they were using AAA talent, which Dr. Wagner was one of them, but he wasn't one of the people they were using.
Well, it was after, basically, a lot of the guys at WCW went off and formed Pro Azteca.
So they
had their own promotion. So essentially, they had whoever was left, which was a mixture of the very young, and the ones who, quite frankly, have seen better days.
So, he's also... It's a great thing I love about Luchador's pages on websites. And he's had a great career in Japan as well. He's done very well. He's always solid in Japan, so he's been able to turn his hand to Japanese style really well, which, is one of the reasons I like Flamita, is Flamita went to Dragon Gate, and all of his stuff looked legit, and it didn't look slow motion choreographed, which sometimes is what Lucha Libre looks like. Also, the amount of mask wager matches he's won over the past 20-odd years. His first one was in 1988. He's never lost one. He's still got his mask.
Yeah.
And he's in his 50s. Tells you how big a star he is.
Because
nearly everybody's dropped their mask by the time they get to 50.
Do you get to keep the masks of the people you beat?
I don't know. I mean, like, Chris Jericho did that, didn't he?
Like the skulls of their enemies. Like in 300. That's what the Persians did, isn't it?
Nice.
Cool.
I don't remember. I wasn't really.
The messenger that turns up in the 300 film, which it's got the skulls of the former, the kings. Oh, it's actually pretty good. Yeah, the skulls of the kings of all the empires they conquered.
I'm surprised you've watched it. I mean, did you see it in an art house 2 years after it came out?
No, I actually watched it because, believe it or not, actually, Jim, I'm quite the amateur historian. I quite like some of my history.
What's your favourite war?
I mean, if you're going to put me on the spot,
he's not going to pick World War II, which is the best one.
The most horrific, and like the one that should like proper knock on that we should not do war, it's a bad thing, is World War II. World War I's fucking hideously depressing. There's a guy called Dan Carlin.
I've never found a war that's a barrel of laughs.
No, but right.
The Crimea was fucking hilarious.
Because I listened to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, and he did a whole thing of like the blueprint to Armageddon, which is about the World War One from before it and after it.
Right.
And it really hammered home like a thing of there wasn't necessarily a bad guy, and there wasn't necessarily that anyone actually wanted to go to war. Whereas like World War Two, there is a full on baddie and there's a full on goodie. Like there's like it's quite clear cut, you know. And then you've got like Alexander the Great, who just had a bit of an ego problem and like.
So I like World War II because of Wolfenstein.
See, I'm an artist. Like most artists, I feel that the best war is the one that hasn't happened yet.
You're listening to Radio 4.
Tweet us. Let us know what your favourite war
is. What's your favourite war? Hashtag Tuesday Night Jaw. Hashtag my favourite war.
And by the way, while you're at it, tell us, what is it good for?
Absolutely nothing.
Say it again.
War?
Stop.
That's a joke from Rush Hour, by the way, everybody. If you listen to this, Chris Tucker. Hi. Christopher, you're number 10.
Okay. Based on my respect for him and the fact that he was the first person I thought of, my number 10 is Robbie Brookside.
Clever.
That was the right noise. I'm hoping
that's also the hipster alarm for him later on.
It's also the Scouse mating call, I believe.
It is.
Yeah, Robbie Brookside, who currently... He found his way to WWE once his in-ring career was pretty much over. And I mean, disclaimer: love Rob to pieces as a human being. He's a mate. He's a joy to be around. And the fact that, first of all, he's fantastic in the ring, and the way he is, he's so unselfish. The way he's changing the wrestling business a bit at a time. For years to come, we will see the influence of Robbie Brookside in the guys that have been through NXT, on WWE, and people will watch it from afar. And I genuinely think he'll make wrestling better far beyond his immediate reach. But the stories, like the stories when he was on the podcast a little while ago, of his early days in pro wrestling, the fact that he hasn't turned out to be a sociopathic serial killer or a horrible human being is a testament to his character, because he was really put through a meat grinder when he started. And, you know, there but for the love of God. I mean, there's in terms of sheer in-ring ability and talent and drive and determination, there was only like a hair's breadth between him and William Regal. So it could have been, you know, I'm sure Mr. Regal will say the same. On any given day, it could have been, they could have had their situations reversed.
Sure.
I feel that Robbie obviously went off to New Japan. He's wrestled around the world. He had a little taste of it in WCW, but again, you know, if we could do a top 10 list, top 20, 30, 40, 50 list of people who didn't quite get what they deserved in WCW. So he's not even top 10 on that list. But imagining what he could have done, particularly in the 80s, late 80s, because he's a little bit older, I think, than Mr. Regal.
A couple of years, I think. A
little bit, not loads. If he'd have come in to WWE, I think he could have been... I don't necessarily think he'd be the first to say he'd have been a big star, as in, I don't think he'd ever been a WWE champion. But imagine him and Regal as a team. Imagine him working, bringing up some of the guys. I think he would have been fantastic. And it absolutely warms my heart that he's getting a chance to take everything he's learned. Because there's a guy who didn't stop believing for the longest time, who's been, if you've read the book The Wrestler, or The Wrestling, I think, by Simon Garfield,
where
there's a chapter about him and, you know, living at his folks and making do. And there's nobody who deserves the success they have more than Robbie Brookside. And fair play, more power to him. I hope he's enjoying a pint outside of a bar in Florida right now where the sun's coming down. And I hope he has many, many years doing what he loves.
Solid choice.
I'm intrigued to see what would have happened had he been found a little sooner.
Yes, good choice. Matthew, your number 10.
My number 10 is Christopher Daniels.
Good choice.
So nearly
on my list. Not.
Yeah. I did my research, because obviously he's done plenty of metal / jacked / Sunday Night Heat match, enhancement match.
And don't forget the fact that he was one of Los Conquistadors.
Oh, yeah. But he's never been a contract, and he's never been Christopher Daniels in WWE. So the reason why I picked Daniels was because he is of the generation of the original Ring of Honor guys, and he was the one that never went. So you had London, Spanky, even Loki, obviously Daniel Bryan as well. And he is sort of Mr. Independent Wrestling for a long time. Like, he did UPW, he seemed to be involved in everything. And then obviously as well, his place in TNA was one of the brighter spots on a relatively dark promotion or period of time, especially with his stuff with AJ and Samoa Joe. And it's weird because he nearly lost out to Jay Lethal because I have so much respect for Jay Lethal. He's a wonderful professional wrestler, but I just think Christopher Daniels has more of an impact on independent wrestling overall.
He's a lot of people's favourite independent wrestler from a certain era.
Yeah.
And I know, talking to when Flash Morgan Webster was on the podcast, he was talking about the impact that Christopher Daniels made on him. And you, whenever you hear any wrestler being interviewed, it's always... Which is why it's so cool that he won the Ring of Honor title this year.
Yeah.
And you look at it and go, oh, he's never won that.
Yeah.
He's never won it.
And he was there at the beginning, and he was part of the first...
Yeah.
That first main event, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And then the Round Robin Challenge.
But I think that's why people are so fond of him, because he is independent wrestling. Like, he is someone that hopefully will get his moment in the sun if he chooses to retire and wants to do anything else, because he genuinely deserves it, because he's been through it all. And I'm not suggesting that anyone sort of like took the WWE contract and ran or anything like that. It's not that at all. But like, he's been through that whole like boom period as well as the dips and everything in between. So yeah, that's the reason why he kind of makes the list, because I think he makes quite a big impact on that scene.
The big thing for me with Christopher Daniels, two things. One, all three of us have had the luxury of meeting some amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky enough, and I've managed to be cool around most of them. I lost my shit when I met Christopher Daniels because I am a huge fan of his. And it goes right the way back. Do you ever, UWA Wrestling Rampage on live TV many years?
I do not remember this.
Right, it was another attempt to launch British wrestling on live TV. They have the Topless Darts and the News Bunny. Right, and they had a big TV recording at Crystal Palace. And it was Phil Powers and Kerry Cabrero and other guys at that point as well. But the guy that absolutely blew me away was this guy, Christopher Daniels, I'd never seen before, but he just looked like a megastar, carried himself like one. And he just, there's nothing he can't do.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he's put somewhere, he makes the most of it.
Yeah. On to number nine. My number nine.
Mighty number nine.
Yeah, it follows on a little bit from what you just your one. It's not Robbie. It does not make my top 10, but I love Robbie to pieces. I could easily have come up with a top 30 for this. Mm. When I start, I wrote things down and then had to pick out a top 10. My number nine is Steve Corino, who now is of course employed by WWE as a coach at NXT. Mm. You can watch loads of Steve Corino's career in ECW on the WWE Network. But I loved Corino when he was at ECW. I am desperate to get him on Tuesday Night Jaw at some point, and having met him a few times over in the States and over here, I think there's a chance I can make that happen, and I hope so, because he's great. He's a great dude. One of the nicest people I've met over the last year for the first time. He's just sound. But one of my favourite feuds ever is him versus Dusty Rhodes in ECW, which I properly love. Yeah. Corino was a great wrestler. He was a great technician and great brawler. He could do both of those things, but he was a fantastic talker back in the ECW days. Did great stuff for 0-1 in Japan, didn't he, as well?
Yeah.
Did great stuff over here for a while as well. And he's always, wherever he's gone, he's always made the most of it. I think if you, the early noughties, to capitalise on how well he'd done in ECW, if he'd have gone into sort of late Attitude Era WWE, with how good he could talk, I think he could have done tremendously well.
Didn't he? I mean, he presumably he had several tryouts as commentator as well, and other bits and pieces.
I think so. But it was weird because I wrote him down, and with all of these, I went on Wikipedia and just checked to see. Because even if you only have the slightest WWE career, it does come up. And I was like, I'm astonished. Mm. You know, and it was weird. I had a conversation with him not so long ago. I was like, I can't believe you never really wrestled it. And I think he'd done, like, everybody had been an extra and done dark matches and whatever. But such a good dude, and it's great again now that he's passing on his knowledge to trainees as they become more and more rounded. So you've got people like Robbie, you've got people like him, you've got people like Norman Smiley, all pointing him in the right direction. Norman Smiley again is someone else who could easily be on this list.
Corino really nearly made my list because he was, again, I've mentioned it a million times on the podcast, but I came into wrestling really late, like in terms of a teenager. So when I started watching ECW, he was champion, and I was like, I loved him, like, because again, like, it was the Dusty thing for me, because I missed out on Dusty, so him having the feud with Dusty and basically ripping off Dusty, and then obviously he did things with like Major League Wrestling when he did the Four Horsemen, whatever it was, and like little bits of that. I always had a massive soft spot for Corino, and obviously like the 0-1 thing as well, like, and how much he like loved Hashimoto and being in that promotion was super cool, man. But yeah, he just missed out on my list as well.
There's a great Hashimoto fact. I don't know if we brought this up before. Who's the first person to ever kick out of Hashimoto's DDT?
Is it Regal?
It was Regal.
Yeah.
He told me that, and he told me that one day we were driving somewhere, and I was like, oh, what a cool fact. What a tremendously cool fact. Like, yes, just looking through Wikipedia yesterday, I realised that yesterday was the date ticked over that Pete Dunne became Progress's second longest reigning champion, because previously it was joint second on 245 days, El Ligero and Nathan Cruz. Yeah. And yesterday, Pete was 246.
Congratulations, Pete.
Congratulations, Pete. Enjoy wrestling Jack Gallagher.
Gallagher now.
Enjoy wrestling our mate Jack in New York.
The Hentleman, Jack Gallagher.
The Hentleman, Gack Gallagher. I was relaying one of my favorites. So every now and again, me, John, and Glenn will get together and we'll just laugh at one joke for ages, and it will end up being a show title inevitably. So we called a show. You know, we don't like to use the sit down gun, which is based on one little 30-second clip from a TV series that's on Netflix called Danger 5, where there's a character in it called Colonel Chessbridge, who has got the head of an eagle. And the first time I saw it, I couldn't stop laughing. There's a clip of him talking to a woman called Claire on it, where he tells her to shut up. She refuses to shut up, so he shoots a gun into the ceiling and says, "Shut your mouth. You know I don't like to use the sit-down gun." And we laughed at that for ages. The one that's doing it at the minute, I can't find a clip of it. So if you can find a clip of this anywhere on the internet, please tweet me, at Jim Smallman. So from The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer, there's an episode of The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer where Vic and Bob are talking to each other, and I think it's Bob that says it. He just goes, "Of course I've got that disease." And he goes, "What disease?" He goes, "That disease where you can't say Shaftesbury Avenue." He says, "Really? Yeah, I can't. I can't say Shaftesbury Avenue. It's terrible." "Well, give it a go. Hang on. Shaftesbury Avenue." And it's been in my head for the last couple of weeks. And I was telling John and Glenn it backstage at our show in Manchester. And on a stressful show day, because we had a few things go wrong that day, it properly popped both of us, all three of us. So if you can find a clip of that, at Jim Smallman, I really need to see the clip of either Vic or Bob not being able to say Shaftesbury Avenue. Thank you.
If anyone can tweet either Vic Reeves or Bob Mortimer, see if they've got it in their personal collection.
If they're wrestling fans, they can have guest tickets. Not for Ali Pali, because we sold all them, soz. Mm-hmm. Also, if you're a friend of mine who thinks you're getting a guest ticket for Ali Pali, soz. We'd rather
fuck
sell
sake,
them.
You've only this is how you tell me.
You'll be all right. What gets me is we occasionally get press requests. Uh-huh. That's not how you're getting into our biggest show of the year. Buy a ticket. Christopher, you're number nine.
My mighty number nine. It is New Jack.
Fucking hell, mate. Shut it down. It's done.
Good night, everybody.
It's been real. Your mate.
My mate, New Jack.
Your chum, New Jack.
I've told that story before.
Yeah. Wasn't funny the first time.
Hey!
I'm sorry, it was. It was quite funny.
For the rest of this episode, the character of Matthew Richards will be played by Stevie Pugh.
Isn't that right, Matt?
Yes.
Brilliant.
It can't be played by Stevie, she's emotionally stable.
Suddenly, Matthew's likeable.
Touché. Fucking well played, mate, well played.
Good night, everybody.
Sorry, Chris.
That wasn't quite how I expected to go. Yeah, New Jack.
I wish I'd had a mouthful of drink so I could have spat it out when you said
not
it.
Not with Pepsi Max and not on Stevie's couch. But no, the reason I say New Jack, and I'm fully aware before Twitter melts, the multitude of reasons why New Jack probably wouldn't have been didn't get signed and wouldn't have lasted. However...
Was a star. You can't argue. Mega he was star. A massive star. And it was one of the reasons I used to buy ECW videos.
Exactly.
Because I loved him.
To say there wasn't a place for him in the Attitude Era is nonsense. Yes. He would have been fantastic. If they'd managed to reel him in a little, tone him down a little bit, and the question is if, he was, without a doubt, one of the most charismatic people I've ever seen in wrestling. For me, when the bell rang, it kind of went off a cliff.
Yeah,
but his promos were magnificent. You believed in him. And
do you know one of my favourite New Jack things ever? You know, Beyond the Mat, when he's really quietly talking about how he wants to be an actor.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, he's doing the screen test and they're going, well, I don't see him being Denzel, but he could certainly be Denzel's friend. Because they do hang out together, don't they? Racist Hollywood. Fuck off.
Easy.
Sorry,
easy.
Come on. It's just because there's no roles for ginger men these days.
Yeah. Game of Thrones.
Fucking Damian Lewis.
Damn it, Dane, I'm coming for you. Coming for you, Ginger. Now, so New Jack is someone who would have been great in WWE, especially because you got imagine him as the hardcore champion. They could have, natural born killers, or whatever the cover version is, playing your way, Dr. D and Square. They could have played their cover version and it would have been incredible.
He's the weirdest. So I, you eventually get used to watching stuff on the network with non-copyrighted music.
He's the only one it's really hard to get used to watching.
I was kind of hoping they'd go all the way with it and just go, you know what, we can't get that, but let's...
Here's Doink's music!
Exactly. Or do you know what? It's surprisingly cheap to get the rights to 5, 6, 7, 8 by Steps. Yeah. You know, just have him coming out, going to make you mine, going to get in time. 5, 6, 7, bang!
That's really good. Also, talking of the network... If you really want to find a really good New Jack thing, find his and was it Mustafa is tag team partner. Find their debut in Smoky Mountie Wrestling.
Oh,
because it is the most like shocking, and when I mean shocking promos, I mean I can't remember who told
this
me
this is when
to
they did
it.
The affirmative action angle, wasn't it? Where they only had to get a 2 count to win.
There is a line in it about trees, and that's all I'm saying. That genuinely, yeah. I have heard some messed up stuff in my time, and I don't know why I didn't swear when I said that. But it like genuinely leave me like slack jaw. Like, oh my god, it's unbelievable.
The boy can
like,
talk, and he also just as an aside, I know it was a little verbal tick, but I now you didn't quite pronounce Smoky Mountain Wrestling,
I know,
right?
Man. Smoky Mountie Wrestling.
I really want to see Smoky Mountie Wrestling
Smoky
now.
Smoky Mountie Wrestling.
Just Jacques Rougeau and a massive joint.
Oh, writes itself.
That's like Kevin Steen's school days all over again.
Matthew, you're number 9.
My number 9 is probably going to be the more controversial choice on my list.
I'm ready in the.
It is technically.
Alarm.
Come on, Jim, give me a hand.
Well,
give
I say technically, it is two people, but
I've got the odd tag team.
So my number 9 is the Young Bucks.
Excellent.
Ooh. So the reason why I picked the Young Bucks is because I think it's hard to.
They're
just,
dead good.
It's not just that because I think people will argue till they're blue in the face about if they're good or they're not good or whatever. Mm. But it's hard to argue about their impact on modern professional, modern independent wrestling. They have influenced it hugely, whether in terms of the perception about merchandise or the idea of what it means to be an independent wrestler and actually be, you know, a rebel, I guess.
Well, look at this as well. Let's say they walked out at NXT unannounced.
Yeah.
So I was at NXT taping where they'd not announced Bobby Fish.
Yeah.
And Bobby Fish, who is a decent star, he's an excellent wrestler, he's a decent level star, but Bobby Fish walked out at NXT TV taping and people lost to wrestle Aleister Black and people lost their minds.
Yeah.
Right? Imagine if the Young Bucks walked out either there or I also think as indie stars go, it could not have opened that Kit Kat any noisier, could he?
No, he tried.
He did. Right? But if you look at it from this point of view. If someone goes from the indies, how recognised are they going to be if they just walk out?
Yeah.
So AJ was a great example. I know he was in New Japan, but AJ was a great example of an indie wrestler who walked straight in to a pay-per-view and everyone lost their minds.
Yeah.
The Young Bucks are famous enough to do that.
Yeah. And
no, I don't think many other people on the indies right now are famous enough to be able to just walk onto television one day and for the internet and the crowd there to lose their minds.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting because again, and like Kenny Omega deserves to be in this conversation. He's not on my list, but he deserves to be in the conversation of that they went from obscurity to where they are now. Yeah. And like I said, I think it's not, I'm not trying to put them in a position and be like they're in ring work or blah, blah, blah. It's them as an entity. Like they really, really embraced and made the most of being independent wrestlers, and I think that's to be applauded, especially in modern times where independent wrestling again is going through a really healthy period, and it is showing, you know, other wrestlers out there that WWE doesn't have to be the destination. I mean, it always probably should be, because if you want to be the best at anything, you want to be in the biggest company and everything, etc. But it's great that there is an example out there for up-and-coming wrestlers to go, well, you can enjoy your time on the independents and make the most of it.
Yep. Good choice, mate. Number 8. My number 8 is Mark Rollerball Rocco.
Lovely.
Mm. Now, people are going to say, well, he competed for the WWF Junior Heavyweight titles. But he did, mainly here and in Japan and in Canada. And he did wrestle the odd match for WWF back when it was a territory. And he was very good friends with Hulk Hogan. But I think that friendship mainly stemmed from wrestling in New Japan rather than...
And their magnificent moustaches.
Yes. He did look like Bob Carroll, geez.
Let's get over that. Weirdly, when we were at the Ritz the other day, we had a different venue manager for the day because the normal guy was on holiday. And this guy was really, like everyone who works at the Ritz in Manchester, really sound guy. And he was talking to me and he went, "Oh, my uncle used to be a wrestler." Now, normally when someone tells me that a relative of theirs was a wrestler, it normally means that they dressed up as The Undertaker occasionally and wrestled at the odd church fete.
Yeah.
And I went, "Oh, what was his name?" And he went, "Rollerball Rocco." And I went, "Fuck off." And he went, "Yeah." I went, "So your uncle is one of the best wrestlers of all time?" And he went, "Yeah, I suppose." He said, "I'm not really into it." I was like, "How could your uncle be Rollerball Rocco and not be into it?"
I had the same thing. One of my mates, Donna, who I work with I've known for like years and years and years and years, worked with her in a horrible call centre in Derby. Just one of those, you know, when your mates when we don't see each other very much, but you're always tight and you catch up and it's great. And then one day she just went, "Oh, my uncle was a wrestler."
Yeah.
Not my uncle, I mean my great uncle. He was sort of like, I didn't know him very well. He passed away when I was young. And then I went, "Really, who?" And then I realised her surname is Kellett.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Mental.
Her great uncle or second cousin, whatever, was Les Kellett.
That's unbelievable. Now the thing with Rollerball, alongside people like Marty Jones, popularised the light heavyweight style that we're all... I mean, that is essentially most of wrestling now.
Mm-hmm.
I saw William Regal tweeting this a little while ago, a match between Rollerball and Marty Jones from World of Sport, which is... You watch it, and it's from about 1979, and you watch it and think, realistically, that could be from 2004. Like, it's so far removed from everything else at the time. I watched Starrcade 83 the other day, and it's amazing how archaic quite a lot of it feels. Some of it's brilliant, but some of it feels so old.
Yeah.
And you look at it, and it could be 1960. Mm-hmm. Like, it's weird how certain... And Rollerball was brilliant at that. He could have been in WWF in two guises. He could have been Rollerball Rocco, dickhead heel.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been Black Tiger and wrestled under a mask and had, you know, and entertained kids around the world. You know, like, he could have done that. He was great at doing all that stuff and had bags and bags of personality. And imagine him and Davey Boy and Dynamite Kid all being in WWE in the mid 80s. That would have been tremendous.
Imagine if it's one of those things where if it had been him instead of Dynamite Kid, for example, in the British Bulldogs, imagine how different things would have been, because they left because of Dynamite Kid in 1988. So
I think what's interesting with Rocco, the only reason why he didn't make my list is because I felt a bit weird about, because he did have the WWF matches and stuff, so I didn't want to put him in for that reason. But I think what was interesting with Rocco is that how physical he was in a World of Sport era that was still physical, but in terms of like kicks and punches and strikes, he was a very physical worker. And like, especially his matches again, like with Dynamite, are cracking. But I think you are right in saying that his stuff with Marty Jones was so head and shoulders and so far advanced of a lot of the stuff that was going on during that time period.
Yeah. Number eight for you, Christopher.
Okay. I'm going down the tag team route as well. And it's fresh in my mind because someone expressed bafflement that they never had a run. And it's the Midnight Express.
Yes. Not the new Midnight Express, who have a run.
Well, calling it a run is probably more of a stumble. You know, sorry, Bodacious, Bondastic, Barber, which way around they were. But yeah, Stan Lane and Bobby Eaton.
That is astonishing.
Obviously, Jim Cornette had his run as a manager. He had Camp Cornette. He worked with Yokozuna and so on and so forth. But the fact that... And it was listening to... Because one of my ways of falling asleep was just like YouTube loop through shoot interviews. And it was a story of how they had a meeting with Vince McMahon in, I think, 88 or 89 to come in. And they just couldn't... They were making too much money. And they weren't going to meet the money side of things. So, you know, there are folk who will go, "It's WWF, I'll do it." And they'll always go, "Well, no, I've got to pay the bills. I'm going to go where the money is." So Stan Lane and Bobby Eaton, who, if you say to anyone, the Midnight Express are the greatest tag team of all time, people won't agree, but they won't say you're stupid. They won't they won't laugh in your face over it. Because, again, it's nice having... When I found pro wrestling, when it found me, whichever way you feel about it spiritually.
Nice.
Bobby Eaton was teaming with Arn Anderson in the Midnight Express.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't appreciate at that time, holy shit, I wish, kind of in hindsight, I'd have gone, what, Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton, like the Midnight Express and the Four Horsemen teaming together, OMG, OMG, OMG. And it wasn't until I went back and I saw some of the Midnight Express's matches, again, years ahead of their time, both in terms of how they were the perfect foil for the Rock and Rolls, the Fantastics, for all these other teams, and that they were so slick and so believable and so good together. And it's just, if they had come in to WWF in 1988 or 89, because I think they went their separate ways in 1990, I believe it was. Mm. So they could have worked with the Hart Foundation, with Demolition, with the Rockers, with all of these guys. Imagine the mouth-watering combinations you could have had against Killer Bees, against the Rougeaus when they were babyfaces, against even the Bushwhackers. Get them, imagine the Midnights and Jim Cornette with the Bushwhackers as foils.
Mm.
That would probably have been their first program, because everyone fought the Bushwhackers first, I think, when they came in. But the potential there was incredible. And to have that kind of profile and that kind of presence and not have a run in WWF is crazy, but credit to them, they did what was best for business.
Mm. Your number eight?
Yeah, number eight was a weird one, because this is sort of the last one where I tried to think of someone a bit outside of the box. So like, I wanted someone that had made a name for themselves in either the NWA or AWA sort of 70s through to 80s. Because,
mm-hmm.
again, I think me discovering AWA was through, first of all, the Mr. Perfect DVD that came out, and then obviously the AWA history one. So this could have been a million people. Like, David Von Erich was on my shortlist for this.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple of others as well. Billy Robinson was another one. Mm. But I chose Nick Bockwinkel.
Mm-hmm.
Purely for the fact that, again, like, I discovered him way, way, way after what he did, but it was the Kurt Hennig matches, and I thought, oh, I'd give it a watch, because obviously I heard the story about them going 60 minutes, and then I watched the match and I was like, holy shit, I see what they're talking about pace. And like, that's the thing with Bockwinkel, when he was AWA heavyweight champion, I think I'm right in saying he was in his 40s.
Oh yeah,
like, he was in his 40s, and bloody hell could he go
loads of, because I think people hear his name and go, oh, he's just one of those wrestlers who was just a wrestler. No, loads of personality as well.
Oh, and he was a fantastic talker, like in that really articulate, slick, suave kind of way. And he was, for me, again, like, it came, I wanted to pick someone who, like, epitomised what, you know, the old sort of NWA world champion. So your Harley Races and your Briscoes and, you know, your Funks before Terry lost his mind. But, you know, that real, like, again, sophisticated, it's like suit wearing professional. And I think Bockwinkel wins out for being the fact that he was the only guy. I made a note, apparently he was in a Legends Battle Royal in like the late 80s on a house show. But yeah, he was a real a guy that I found quite interesting, because I accidentally stumbled across, and then, like you said, I thought he was just this name that fit in with, you know, Fez and, you know, like Ed Strangler Lewis and all these names. And then I watched his stuff, and again, this was in the 2000s, and I was blown away by his athleticism and, as like you said, the overall package of him. So that's why I snuck him in.
Good.
At number eight.
Good sneakage.
Well, my number seven will be quite short and sweet, because it's already been featured by someone else. My number seven is the Young Bucks.
Good choice.
Thanks, mates. I know, I did my research into it, they have both been, both Nick and Matt have been on WWE shows as extras, including once on the old ECW show, dressing up as Triple H and Shawn Michaels.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Okay, yeah. On the dirt sheet.
Yeah, which is mental, if you think about it. Yeah.
Was that where the party started?
Yes. And I mean, they've got a great canon of brilliant work. So Ring of Honor, PWG in particular, New Japan, loads and loads of great work. Bags of personality, the point you made about them changing the merch game, all brilliant. But also, even now, when I watch them,
they make me feel like I felt when I was 13 years old and I used to watch The Rockers. Mm-hmm. That's genuinely how they feel. I always look at them and go, you're Sean and Marty. And that's how I, like, I feel like a kid watching them. Because I know, ring psychology-wise, they're not everyone's cup of tea.
No.
But I like it whenever people... I think someone tweeted them a little while ago about them super-kicking someone to kill them. They said, oh, I really don't like this person. You should super-kick them. Either Nick or Matt replied with, well, it'll take 27 to do the job. Which is like, they've got a sense of humour about it. And wrestling is constantly evolving. If we all take the old-school mentality... I found myself, as I approached 40, I found myself as a wrestling promoter saying, oh, these kids. And then stopping myself and thinking, well, hang on, in... Let's say I'm still promoting wrestling in 10 years' time. I'll be nearly 50. And I will be of a very different mindset to the crowd of Progress or wherever I'm promoting. So, you know what I mean? Wrestling's always changing. And I think we have to salute people like the Young Bucks because they are entertaining as fuck. They're the sort of people that put a Young Bucks match on in front of non-wrestling fan wife and she will squeal at least once when they do something bizarre and she'll probably have a laugh. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, sometimes the believability goes one way, but you know what, they're fun, and wrestling's meant to be fun, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think this is why I found it so difficult to find modern wrestlers for this list. Like I have some, but I think
I've not got many.
but it's true, because it's that thing of the people either go, you know, relatively quickly to WWE now, or people don't for whatever reason rock the boat. Or, you know, you've got people that, like, I think it is to be said that, again, like, that's such a good point about, oh, these kids. But it is always these kids that are buying the product and falling in love with wrestling, because we were those kids. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we sat through the Attitude Era and ECW, and you guys probably sat through even worse WCW earlier on, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's such an important thing to constantly remember of... And even to go back to the point about Rocco and Marty, like, you know, you hear Regal talk about that match and say, oh, the reactions people had to that match back in 1970, whatever, they said they were ruining the business. And it's like, I think that's what's really interesting. And I think it's great to see now that a lot of the independent wrestlers, especially in the British scene, are guys that a few years ago were relatively obscure and were probably perceived as being like, oh, well, why are you doing that? That's not what everyone else does. And it's like, well, that's the point. Like, uh-huh. You know, that people have changed that whole ideal. And now WWE has evolved. The WWE main event picture compared to what it was 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago, is night and day. And I think that's important to highlight, especially in like modern wrestling, that is constantly evolving.
It's, if we'd have been doing this 5 years ago, the lists would have been very, very different.
Yeah.
Because you were spoilt for choice in terms of great contemporary wrestlers who had never had a WWE run.
Yeah.
And now,
yeah,
let's be honest, now that WWE have gone, wait a minute, we're the best wrestling company in the world.
Yeah.
Let's get all the best wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
And most part, they're doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Christopher, you're number seven.
My number seven is The Great Muta.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
Yeah. A guy who was very limited in considering, in terms of full-time work in the US, he was like a year.
Yeah.
A year. And then sporadic appearances. And then a guy who reinvented himself and reinvented himself and reinvented himself and basically played two characters on New Japan. He feuded with himself, essentially. You know, he was in the NWO and he wasn't at the same time. And then he went to All Japan. And at the point where everyone thought, well, he's broken, he can't do anything else, all of a sudden, Shining Wizard, off we go, shave his head. You know, he's a new guy. Imagine that evolution taking place in WWE. Imagine that. I mean, imagine if I'm not saying it could have. But, and until recently, frankly, the odds are he would have been given Mr. Fuji as a manager and the Orient Express music.
Mm.
You know, he could have been replacing Sato, quite frankly.
I love that for a long time, if you were from Japan in WWE, you were only allowed to be from Tokyo.
Yes.
It's like creating a character on a video game. You're only allowed to be from one city.
Yes,
it's
absolutely.
Like, you know, considering, I think out of all my favourite Japanese wrestlers, none of them are from Tokyo.
No.
I love Muta when I was growing up, partly because there was several characters in video games that were based on Muta. Mm. And so seeing him in WCW for the first time made me go, ooh. And also he spat a mist, which when I was doing e-wrestling, my characters always used to spit mist because it's a cool as fuck thing to do. Really difficult to do in reality.
You end up dribbling down your chin.
Well, it also involves keeping a condom full of food colouring in your mouth for an entire match. I mean, that's not as nuts as the Shawn Michaels blading thing where there is, I forget which show it is, Shawn Michaels used to keep his blade in his mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Which is mental. And there's a point where he gets knocked out of the ring and he spits the blade out, blades, gets rid of the blade before he lands outside the ring. That's
Jesus.
That's fucking dynamo level shit. Yeah.
I hated Muta the first time I saw him.
Did you?
Yeah, hated him. In the best possible way.
Because you meant it.
Because, yeah, exactly. Because he was the guy who was beating up Sting. Mm. And it was Future Shock 89, Stark 89 Future Shock, where it was him and Sting. And Sting couldn't get anything on him at all.
Yeah.
I hated him for it.
But he did a moonsault as well. People forget how mind-blowing it was the first time you see someone do a moonsault.
Handspring elbow.
Mm. Loads of kicks.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he was great.
Every time he started the match and he'd throw that roundhouse and whoever their opponent was, they'd go, oh, shit, and back away.
And, of course, the two things you should go and look up that Muta did are the Muta scale. So when the Muta scale, we've talked about this on the podcast before, the Muta scale is if you are 1.0 Muta, then you are bleeding more than it's possible to bleed in a wrestling match.
You are actually having a transfusion as you bleed.
You're Eddie Guerrero against JBL. That's the American reference to it. This all comes from a match with Tsurashi Hayes, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Where there's one point where Hayes bites him in the head and just spits out a chunk of flesh. That's how gory this match is. That's not my favourite Japanese Muta match. My favourite one is his match against Jinsei Shinzaki or Hakushi.
Oh, good lord.
Which is dark versus light.
Stop talking dirty to me. Please, this match is fucking brilliant.
It's the whole thing, it's White Monk against Satan. Mm-hmm. The whole point of that match is he is Satan.
Yes.
Like, that is. There are video games where there's many a video game where the final boss is Satan in Japan.
Yes.
And Great Muta, for a long period of time, was essentially the devil's representative on Earth.
So he was the final boss of New Japan.
He was. He really was. But his feud with Jinsei Shinzaki leading to a match where, I mean, he comes out, even just these fucking fire-breathing dragons on his shoulder and
so
everything.
Gangster.
It's fucking tremendous.
Can I tell you about one of my favourite recent Jinsei Shinzaki stories?
Yes.
So I randomly... I got recommended on Twitter, God bless Twitter, to watch a Michinoku Pro main event, which was the great Sasuke, or Sasuke, whatever would you pronounce it, against...
I thought it was called Great Sassy.
That is now how he's being referred to.
How sassy.
So the Great Sassy... Mm-hmm.
the only thing Great Sasuke ever says on it mm-hmm. is... Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Great Sasuke
He's a politician
Sasuke,
as well.
Yeah. Former. Against the Brahmin brothers.
Yeah.
And Sasuke on his team has got the new Sailor Boys, which is the Brahmin brothers' old gimmick. Oh, sorry, one of my alarms is just going off.
Time to get it.
So, yeah, so he's got the new Sailor Boys versus the Brahmin brothers, who their partner is Hakushi. So not Shinzaki, Hakushi. So they bring a fucking coffin to the ring, right? They end up having this mad match that's just genuinely insane. Hakushi rises from the dead. They resurrect Hakushi, who then goes on this fucking tear, but everyone realises what a catastrophic, fucking terrible decision this is. As Hakushi's just running riot, literally running through the whole Michinoku Pro like roster. So Sasuke and the new Sailor Boys end up like having to fight with the Brahmin brothers to take Hakushi down, right? And this is how like they end up, the match finishes, whatever. And the way they get rid of Hakushi, and me and my housemate Cooper pissed ourselves laughing at this, because like Sasuke started to control him and lead him off towards the coffin, and then like he had this cloth with him that he put round him, and I jokingly went to Cooper, he's gonna fucking make him disappear. And honestly, and we laughed
30 seconds before Great Sasuke fucking made Haku disappear. It's the, one of the best, like, it's like Penn and Teller level of magician shit. And Haku, she just disappears. And oh my god, it's the greatest thing in the world ever.
Like, that means he could appear anywhere.
Exactly.
Don't mention him again.
Hakushi.
Nah.
Oh, it's amazing. It's on the internet somewhere, but it's one of the greatest, like, sleight of hand magic trick from one of the best, most insane wrestlers in the world.
Whew. Good. Anything else to add about Great Muta before we make him do his number seven?
He's dead good, wasn't he?
He was dead good. Good rounding up. Number seven, Matthew.
My number seven is a previously mentioned Marty Jones. And the reason I picked Marty was because I didn't feel right picking Rocco because he had a very loose association.
See, I nearly picked Marty. It was Marty or Rocco for me. So yeah. I'm glad you picked him.
And it's pretty much exactly the same reasons you picked Rocco in terms of the influence that his style has had over junior heavyweight style, as well as like you said, rightfully so, the whole of like professional wrestling. And I think the thing with Marty to be applauded is that he could have gone everywhere and done everything and stuff like that, but for whatever happened or whatever reasons, he didn't. And I think that kind of makes him a little bit more, like, in my mind, remembered slightly more fondly. Like, he's the other guy, but he deserves all the credit in the world. And, you know, it's again, for someone that now knows Marty relatively well, you know, to the point where I'd say it was an acquaintance or a friend, I still have little moments where I'm like, that's Marty Jones, that, and that's mental. Like, you know, and yeah, he's got such a great body of work. Like, go back and watch it, and he's nails as well. The hardest man in the world.
I think it's safe to say as well, I mean, it's easy to forget that people's influence is beyond their own actions. I mean, we wouldn't be sat here having this conversation if it wasn't for Marty Jones. Mm. Because without Marty Jones, he wouldn't have trained William Regal. Without William Regal, I certainly know, I mean, Jim and I were silly mates, but we probably wouldn't have the connection of having these conversations that we do now. And, you know, the impact he's had, it's... In terms of ripples throughout the entire industry, quite spectacular when you think about it.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So, to number six, my number six is a man that me and Chris Brooker once made corpse during an actual match, Homicide. Homicide's one of my favourite indie wrestlers ever, for a couple of reasons. One is his finisher is the best finisher in the history of wrestling. I know he didn't invent it. It was Kudo invented it, wasn't it? The vertebraker, cop killer.
I thought it was Helms.
No, he lifted it off. Like most people, he lifted it off a Japanese
Megumi
woman.
Kudo?
Oh, yeah.
He's a Kudo driver. So,
yeah, now you said it.
That's what it's called in WWE 2K17, anyway. It's called the Kudo driver. Because I'm probably not allowed to call it a cop killer or gringo killer, depending on which incarnation of Homicide you've got. Homicide in Ring of Honor was a joy Unless you were feuding with him, then it was terrifying. His feud with Steve Corino is brilliant. His feud with Colt Cabana, where he poured Drano into his mouth, is brilliant.
Although, strictly speaking, Drano is kosher, yeah. So it's okay.
He is one of the most terrifying 5'10" wrestlers you will ever come across. And me and Christopher, we genuinely made him corpse at a TNA show when he was part of LAX, who were a great underrated tag team, him and Sean Hernandez. They were brilliant, but they were wrestling Petey Williams and someone else at a show in Coventry. And we were chanting stuff like the dicks that we were back then, because we went into business for ourselves, guys.
We are awesome, though.
We are awesome. And we made him laugh. You could see him doing the full Steve Austin corpse, head on arm, on top rope, shaking. And Homicide, still great now, he's in LAX again now. I think he's about 40 years old, similar age to me. But back his Ring of Honor glory days, and imagining him, I always view Savio Vega was kind of a. If you've watched Savio Vega in Puerto Rico, he was so intense. And then, with the exception of the matches that he had with Steve Austin at the beginning of Austin's WWE career, he kind of fizzled out a little bit. And he was always solid, and everyone knew he was solid, but he wasn't exciting. And he could have been. And I think Homicide, mid-noughties. Homicide coming in as a heel in post-Attitude Era WWE would have terrified people, and he would have been absolutely brilliant. So yeah, Homicide's my number six.
He could have been, what, New Jack?
I just popped into my head.
Yeah, he was New Jack.
New Jack who could behave.
New Jack who could, well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far necessarily, but then compared to New Jack,
yeah,
fucking everyone behaves.
Yeah.
Russell Brand behaves compared to New Jack, but it's, yeah, I mean, Homicide is incredibly charismatic, isn't it? He's such a, and he's believable. And did I ever tell you the story about one of my favourite things is watching, it's when very, very white people try to be Homicide. I mean, when I say whiter than me,
yes.
You know, you get the feeling. Yes. And it was at Ring of Honor in Liverpool where someone who couldn't roll his R's was trying to, because, you know, seeing Homicide and Julia Smokes together is great. Because they, you know, especially in Liverpool with all these comic book geeks, which is what most of us are at heart, seeing these two proper street thugs walking around, bruh, bruh, you know. And there was a guy sat next to me who probably will now be a hipster. You know, he was a pre-hipster hipster. But he was trying to do it but couldn't. So he was just going, bruh, bruh, bruh. You've let yourself down. You've let your family down.
You've let everybody down.
That's why I love Homicide. Julius Smokes.
Yeah.
Also, just had the idea of Homicide with Stokely Hathaway.
I love Stokely Hathaway. He's doing progress in New York.
I know. He's he's one of my favourite things in the world.
So I only briefly got to meet him when we did our shows with Evolve. And him coming out, introducing Timothy Thatcher, and then with all sincerity, basically running down an entire crowd and then just going, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, good night, and just walking back again is one of the coolest things. I've told him, one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And, yeah, the fact that he lives in New York was of great assistance to him being on our show. But he really wanted to be. Like, his 30 for 30 thing is up on YouTube today. And loads of people have been tweeting me, telling me how good it is. So I'm looking forward to watching that later on.
That's going on the list.
I love Stokely.
Yeah.
Super, super happy a bit of progress show. Christopher, you're number six.
My number six. Christopher Daniels. Oh, no, wait. I've changed my mind. Curry Man.
Oh, he's hot.
He's the same person. You're more than one.
Whoa!
What? Sorry, guys.
Jesus.
Sorry to break it to you. Anyway, Christopher Daniels.
Yeah, there you go. We've kind of covered CD.
Yeah,
my boy, C Dizzle.
My boy, C Dizzle. Your number six, then.
My number six is.
You just write the 30 for 30 documentary notes on your phone.
Yeah,
this is why I love you, Matt.
Well, because I'm organised.
Yeah,
because I've got a memory of an actual fish.
Yes, you have.
I'm an idiot.
Not a goldfish. One of the better ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A carp.
Yeah. Talking of carps, you could argue.
What a link.
You could argue.
Have you chosen Ronson Green?
You could argue that he's the king carp. No, it's a terrible segue. It's got nothing to do with the person I'm going to choose it on.
You should have just owned it. You should have just owned it.
Nothing to do with the poisson.
But no.
Come on! Never topping that! French and a pun, get in.
Bravo.
This is why I can't commit to these things, because I've got two stand-up comics staring at me.
I told them.
But I'm sick of
it. I told a Noam Dar joke on stage on Saturday night.
Good luck. Go on, get it in before
okay.
I do it.
All right. So Noam Dar, don't ask Noam Dar what date it is. Ask his brother Callan.
Nice.
And talking of calendars, my number six is a man for all seasons. It's not Xander Cooper, but it is the quintessential British wrestler. It is Johnny Saint. And the reason why I picked Johnny Saint, again, is it's that thing of, we had a conversation before, like very briefly, about would he have done big things in WWE or WWF? And the answer is probably no, because, you know, he would have come in and had some absolutely insane matches against some wonderful lightweights and would have gone on his merry way. But I think he deserves the mention, because he is British wrestling after Big Daddy and Giant Haystacks. You know, he's the guy that everyone goes, oh yeah, you know, like, and he was this wonderful mix of this rugged northerner with a tattoo that had the finesse of a ballet dancer, but then could also break your arm.
Yeah.
But would mesmerise you, and he had this charisma about him that was just charming. Like, I think that's the one thing that I always take away from some of my favourite World of Sport wrestlers, is how charismatic some of my favourites are. Like, for instance, I really like Steve Gray, but he wasn't the most charismatic man. But one of my favourite World of Sport wrestlers is Vic Faulkner, who recently passed away, very sadly. But the reason why I loved Vic Faulkner is he had that beautiful balance of being this charming, witty gentleman and then an absolute magician. Like, one of my, like, I know Mr. Gallagher's a massive fan of Faulkner, and it's the one where he brings the referee over and says, Mr. Referee, and then uses him to escape the hold. And it's just wonderful little moments like that. And obviously the master of that style and that art was Johnny Saint. And it was wonderful to see. I'm sure you both watched the video recently after he spent time in NXT. Mm-hmm. And in the most northern British way, going, yeah, well, thank you very much for that. Right, we have none of that anymore. Stop clapping, get back to training, see you later. Nice one. It was beautiful, but he is an absolute pioneer of that style, and I think he should be still spoke about today with such you know, praise and accolades, because he was phenomenal.
So the reason I didn't put Johnny on my list, despite him being the reason I like wrestling, the first reason I like wrestling, I'm very lucky that I've got to tell him that in person, and he's been on Tuesday Night Jaw, is just, I feel that the absolute peak of his career was just a bit before WWE became a national company. Yeah. And that's I was trying to think about that from that point of view of, you know, him in the late 70s, he would have been perfect. And I don't think, I think I've spoken to him about it, he didn't really come to America. He went to Japan a little bit, but he wasn't really bothered about America. Well,
was he one of the guys who kept his day job as well?
At
some point, so towards the end of his career, from something he told me recently, I think he had a corner shop in Blackpool. And
But
most of the time, from when he was on Tuesday Night Joy, you'd hear that he was away 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. So back when wrestling was insane, he did go into, because people forget, he's 76.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Which is like, so he is 37 years older than me. And 9,000 times fitter than I am or will ever be. Like, it's such amazing shape.
And he also struck me as the kind of guy you could always trust to have a thermos on him. You know what I mean?
It probably
he
does.
He could beat you up, but if he'd make you a cup of tea or Bovril, he'd have a mug of Bovril for you afterwards.
And I think what's wonderful as well about him being at the Performance Center is there's going to be a new generation of wrestlers that might not necessarily be wrestlers or wrestling fans before they were in the Performance Center, that might have little tricks that Johnny Saint's taught them. Which isn't that just a wonderful thing?
Yeah,
what a wonderful moment that's going to be to see a former bodybuilder, you know, use a slight leverage tweak that Johnny Saint did. That's going to be brilliant. And you can tell as well, like, his time there from just seeing how everyone reacted to him and the way people spoke about him, how respected he is, and that's genuinely lovely to see as well. It's you know, especially for people like us who are very proud and happy to be part of Brit wrestling as well. So yeah,
cool. Right, we're into our top fives. Number five for me hasn't been mentioned yet. I think is one of the best heels in wrestling history.
Ooh.
And that is Art Barr.
Ooh. Ooh.
So, unfortunately, he passed away in 1994. I would have put a huge fan of Eddie Guerrero, so I would have loved it if Art and Eddie could either team together or feuded with each other in WWE during Eddie's time in WWE. I think he would have ended up in ECW with Eddie and Dean and Chris
that was,
Benoit and everybody.
I believe the initial interest in Eddie was that Paul Heyman wanted to bring them into work Public Enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you ever want to see heat, watch Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero against El Hijo del Santo and Octagon Junior.
World Collide, wasn't it?
No, it's just Octagon, not Octagon Junior. Yeah. From when Worlds Collide. It is a 5-star Dave Meltzer match. It's a 2 out of 3 falls match, which is normal for Lucha. Tag team rules. There's no tags, which is normal for Lucha. It's obscene. That's a hair versus mask match. And yeah, it is... Yeah. But like you've never seen hatred like it. Ever. And his charisma... I love Eddie. Art was as good as Eddie Guerrero.
Art was more. I mean, we all know how charismatic Eddie Guerrero is now, but Eddie was very much in his shadow to the point where when I saw when Worlds Collide on 17th generation VHS, crackling away, fiddle with the tracking, all that shit. Eddie was the workhorse. Mm. Eddie was the guy who was the straight man. And considering what Eddie went on to do, the thought of someone being so charismatic that Eddie was in their shadow is almost mind blowing.
Yep. Invented the frog splash.
Yeah.
Which is pretty sweet. And also that match we just mentioned happened 2 weeks before he died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it wasn't like he had that and then there was a couple of years of him, oh, is he going to come? No, that match was 2 weeks before he passed away. Now that is like just the thought of what he could have achieved. Mm. And I know there's one of the reasons that he may not have ended up in WWE was to do with his past, which is the same reason that he went to Mexico in the first place and was like, oh, WCW and stuff.
Yeah.
But in terms of a character and someone who just got being a heel, that go and see that match because it's ludicrous. I mean, there's also some great mullets. But that match
spectacular
is...
Spectacular mullets. Not real mullets, either. They had to give them hair extensions.
To make it more
worthwhile? Well, no, because it's a genuine true story. Yeah, is that they just come from Japan, and the Nasty Boys...
I have heard this story.
Yeah, they roofied him. They spiked his drink and then shaved his head.
Because they knew he had a
hair versus hair. Versus hair, so they had to give him extensions. So he was very much a pioneer for the divas, as well as for himself. But also... What about his WCW gimmick, which makes me laugh?
The juicer.
Yeah. Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
Back when they didn't give a shit about copyright, Arachnaman versus the juicer could have been amazing and shut the company down.
And also, let's be honest, calling a wrestler from the 90s the juicer.
Yeah.
That works on so many levels. I've never made that connection, but yeah.
He's not a Nutribullet. It's the other type of juice,
guys.
Do you
reckon he'd have had a tremendous career feuding with Pete Gass?
There's the puns, guys. It's no croissant, but it's still pretty good. Who's your number five, Christopher?
My number five is a man who immediately made me go, who is this, when I saw him on WCW very briefly in the 1990s. I like how we're doing stars in their eyes intros now.
Is it Le Parker?
No.
Oh.
Shut up. Do your own list, dickhead. Yeah. It's Le Parker. No, it's not Le Parker.
Blitzkrieg.
Shall I do it?
Yeah, you do it, yeah. Yeah, do it, come on.
You're just basically ruining the rest of my list now, aren't you? Yeah. It is Scott Norton. Flash, Scott Norton.
Flash.
Oh. He arm wrestled every one of us.
Yeah.
I'm not even sarcastically on board for this. I fucking love Scott Norton.
Who doesn't love... You know who doesn't love Scott Norton? People who are wrong. That's the kind of people Scott they don't
like. I love playying with him in WCW NWO Revenge and using his shoulder breaker as a finisher. Oh,
shoulder breaker, which I believe is still a legit finish.
Yeah, we're bringing it back.
Don't look at me like that.
Godfather rocked the shit out of a shoulder breaker.
Tell you what, let's get Scott Norton over here. You take the shoulder breaker and you tell us if it's a legit finish.
He was in the arm wrestling film, wasn't he?
Over the top.
Over the Top, which, if you want to listen to a great episode of a podcast, the How Did This Get Made live episode about Over the Top is probably my... I think I've listened to that one episode. I think it's on Stitcher Premium now, so you have to pay for it. But I've listened to that one episode 30 times. It's so funny. They don't even mention Scott Norton, but they mention arm wrestling at great length.
So big Scott Norton, man. Also, there's a great footage of him and Yukon John Nord doing an awful promo about flapjacks. Yeah, about pancakes. Go look for that.
I mean, people forget as well, his legacy in WCW is fine. His legacy in New Japan is massive.
Yeah. Also, I mean, Scott
Norton... He was a Wrestle King of this year, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Scott Norton.
And he's the kind of guy who looks like... He looks like the Juggernaut from X-Men in real life. He looks like, you know, he's proper, you don't want to shoot Norton, you'll just make him mad. You know, he is hard as nails, bigger than life. You know, I'm surprised he just wrestled in Tokyo, didn't trample the fucker. And the first time I saw him, he turned up on WCW murdering people, back in the days of squash matches, and he had a match at Slamboree against Sting. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen. He faced the Convict instead, who was
Nails.
Yeah.
In his only WCW appearance.
Yeah, yeah. And then he came back. He was part of the NWO, Vicious Delicious, all that stuff. But he's one of those guys where when he came down the aisle, he went, oh, God, someone's fucked.
Yeah.
He's got that. And I messaged him on MySpace way back in the day. When I first found MySpace and I realised...
Please tell me his MySpace picture was taken from above.
Satellite. Otherwise they couldn't fit his immenseness in. So he was on MySpace, and it was back when it was such a rarity that people would reply. And I'd written a blog about wrestling and comedy, comparing them to each other. And I sent it to him and said, have a look, what do you think? And he went, are you sure you're not a wrestler? And I marked the fuck out for several days. Didn't leave the house, just walked around in circles. And I said, I actually got to say... Why didn't you have that match with Sting? Because I was really looking forward to it. And he said two words, Ole Anderson. And yeah, so clearly something happened. No. Ole fucked him up and he left because it was in 1993. But then, you know, even in like one of my favourite matches from Nitro, when things were a little bit fucking rank, you know, when things weren't healthy, you know, when The Rock was setting in, was when Ernest the Cat Miller was reviled by internet fans. But he was doing this amazing heel work. And he was unbeaten. And then he had a match with Scott Norton, who knocked the fuck out of him. And I thought it was brilliant. And just, he's so believable, such a badass. I loved, again, one of my favourites to play as in WCW and NWO Revenge. Great moves. Powerbomb wasn't even his finish. It was just one of his moves. And then, you know, if he'd have been, he was IWGP champion during a bit of a so-so period, I think it was. And if it had been a little earlier or a little later, I mean, the Jurassic Powers, what a great name for a tag team as well.
It's one of my favourite names for a tag team.
Him and Hercules. And I think it's Stevie's favourite name for a tag team because it's got Jurassic in it.
I think it's only second to Miracle Violence.
That's the best one. That's the best one.
Yeah. I think only second to that, which is high.
I won't hear a word said against Eminem.
I also like Bad Intentions.
Great. Is it Great Bash Heel or Get Great Heel Bash?
Great Bash Heel.
Yeah, that's
GBH. Great Bash Heel.
GBH.
You're making these up as you go, aren't
you? Oh, no, that's what's great about him, yeah.
Who's your number five?
Now, I could tell you my number five.
Just fucking tell us!
Or, I could show you
a contemporary dance.
I could go through an elaborate card trick to show you...
Put your card
...who my number
on,
five
mate.
Is, which is probably a little bit of a suggestion, because my number five is Nigel fucking McGuinness.
Oh, do you know what? So what? We have dissent in the room.
Yes. Right, so the thing with Nigel is, I'm not just picking Nigel because he's a phenomenal... technical wrestler and a phenomenal wrestler and also a very nice chap as well. He's a bloody lovely bloke.
He was nearly on my list.
The thing with Nigel is, and you were there when I got to say this to him, I was very lucky to present showing of his documentary and have a very brief Q&A with him and have a chance. It was the first time I met him and I'd sit down and have a chat with him. And I was watching this documentary and I was watching him wrestle Bryan Danielson and Tyler Black and fucking Claudio Castagnoli and Chris Hero and all the people who went for Ring of Honor. Like, and it struck me that Nigel McGuinness was about 10 years ahead of everyone else. That European flair mixed with what's probably called strong style now. Like, Nigel was doing that with the Pure title as well as the Ring of Honor world title. And his stuff with Daniel Bryan is some of the most... And there's not much I can't watch in wrestling. Keeping in mind that I watch Tournament of Death every year religiously, love it, no problem. There's not much that in wrestling that I can't actually go back and watch. And the one thing is the ring post spot with Daniel Bryan in Liverpool, which is one of the most horrific things that's ever happened in a professional wrestling match. But it's that thing of, I mean, it obviously didn't do him any favours going forward, but his legacy, it should be remembered as well as being the guy that was almost the guy. Mm. And I think obviously Nigel, if you watch his documentary, had to deal with that a lot in his life because, you know, if you don't realise how close Nigel was, he had a contract and had it ripped away with him. And then not only that, but saw all his friends and all these people that he'd come through with go on to achieve great things. So I think with Nigel, it's quite a sad story, but at the same time, we should focus on the positive side of it, which was that he's influenced a whole generation of wrestlers, including the likes of Zach Gibson, obviously, is one of the most obvious ones. Bless him. you've been rumbled, mate. But I think the thing as well is that it's like...
He's been recognised.
It's funny because I don't think I appreciated Nigel in that moment.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's why he makes my list, is that one of them people that when you go away and really think about it and go back and watch his work and go, you were genuinely one of the best professional wrestlers ever, really. And that's why he's on my list.
Good choice. Ring of Honor world champion for over 500 days as well.
And he used the word wanker in a promo, which gets my vote.
My number four is a tag team. You could tell us who it is.
I'm going to.
Or
it's the Briscoes.
Nice.
The Briscoes are, I mean, Jay's been Ring of Honor champion twice. I look at tag teams. I always think there's one tag team that defines an era all the time. So the Dudleys were it for a long period of time, for example. And like the Rock and Roll Express were it for a long period of time, and so on. And with the Briscoes, I think the mid-noughties, from sort of 2005, 2006, to about now, the Briscoes have been the best tag team in the world. Now, I know people go, oh, the Young Bucks. I love the Young Bucks. They're on this. They're in my list. But I think the Briscoes are... I think everything they do looks more painful. I think as what two wrestlers should look like, they look like they would rip your head off and kill you. Mm-hmm. In many ways, they would do that anyway if they weren't wrestlers. They are genuinely terrifying. I'm also aware that choosing them gives a certain bit of controversy because, for example... I know Jay in the past has said some very offensive stuff, which is probably one of the reasons they've never ended up there. I didn't realise that when he said some stuff about gay marriage, and I didn't realise, because I remember reading about him saying that and thinking, oh, that's a shame, because I really like those guys, but I can't get on board with someone who says something like that. Mm. I didn't realise how much he'd apologised for that after it, and said it was I shouldn't have done it, I was acting in character, and then he donated his next two shows worth of fees to... a charity, an anti sort of hate speech charity, and I was like, oh, I didn't know that. So that actually made him go back up in my estimations again. Mm. The stuff that they've been doing in Japan recently has kind of reinvigorated them. They're always going to be a central part of Ring of Honor. I think they're probably the most central part of Ring of Honor in its in its history, and they've never been anywhere. Mm. And I'm because they're both big lads, and I think they've got a ready-made gimmick, right? I mean, they're not the Godwins, but they are country boys. They're boys from Delaware. It's not a gimmick. That's them. Yeah. And that's why they're so believable. And to sort of cross-reference you know, the X and the Y axis, we've discussed Young Bucks and Briscoes. Mm. One of my favourite matches I've seen live was the Young Bucks versus the Briscoes at York Hall, which I went into going, I don't really get the Young Bucks, and I left going, that was amazing. That was so much fun.
But I think if they had the right guidance, I think if they're in WWE, they'd have to slow the fuck down, because they do a lot of head drop moves, and they do a lot of everything in every match. Mm-hmm. But and then if you look at then the one of the reasons they're higher than the Young Bucks for me is if you look at the value of splitting a team up, I think if you split the Young Bucks up, Matt and Nick aren't, but they're not as exciting when they're not a team. And I know they never want to be split up.
No.
Jay and Mark, as separate wrestlers and feuding with each other and then going their separate ways, they could go on to have their own.
Well, they weren't even a tag team when they first happened. They were feuding, weren't they?
So. Yeah. But I think.
And then when Jay was champion, yeah. Mark. There was a long time when they were Briscoe A and Briscoe B, and they just looked the same. And then Mark started doing the wet redneck kung fu thing, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
Just, oh man, they're so good.
But I think it's probably been stuff they've said that has kept them away from WWE. Because if you look at them, they are phenomenal. They're one of the best tag teams of a generation. And for them to have not had that chance is genuinely surprising. Mm. But again, take away the stuff that they've said, which is, you know, certainly abhorrent, but and has been apologised for. But I think them in the ring, just like, I've never watched a Briscoe Brothers match I've not enjoyed.
Imagine them now again in WWE, them versus the Usos in 2017 would be absolutely fantastic. Them versus the Revival.
Them versus the Revival would be absolutely ridiculous.
Southern style, it would be like the Fantastics and the Midnight Express all over again. It'd be amazing.
I think it'd be more like the Fantastics against the Sheep Herders, which is a 5-star match. And no, it's the Bushwhackers. Go back, it's on the network. Go and watch it. It's a 5-star match that ends in a double disqualification after 10 minutes. And the heat off that, fuck me, brilliant. Number 4, Chris.
To call this next man.
Stop it! His phone's just, he's got notes on his phone and it's just full of intros. No list. Anyway, go on, Spud. Who have you got? Number 4.
Spud.
Spud. Oh, that Spud. That trainee was doing Ringo for us the weekend.
9 months in, and I see more promise in him than in that time Misaharu Misawa was helping us set up the ring at Grand Pro Wrestling a few years ago, you know. He's all right. Let's go backwards with this. The fact that this is a guy who can make anything happen. He is a guy. He's the anomaly of anomalies. He's 5'4" or something like that. 5'5", and there is nothing he cannot make work. Mm. I swear to God, if ever there's someone who can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, it's Spud. The fact that right now he is doing one of my favourite things, not just in wrestling, but in life, as the guy who's had a knock on the head and thinks it's 2002, which he has made out of circumstances that are less than ideal.
Mm.
He's found himself in a bit of a corner, and he's gone, you know what, I'm just going to do something with it. And it's one of my favourite things in the world. He is consistently, brilliantly entertaining. He can be funny. He can be loathsome. He can be the underdog that you want to see win. He's got fire. He's got charisma. He can talk. He can wrestle. He can do pretty much anything in the ring that the guys who are indie darlings can do, but chooses not to.
Yeah.
And it's ever since I saw him come out as Rockstar Spud for the first time at a 1PW show, I thought, Jesus, you're brilliant. Everything he's done that I've seen him do since then has just blown me away. He is, if he was 6'2", he'd be the first British world champion. That I honestly, genuinely believe if he was 6'2". But if he was 6'2", he wouldn't have had to learn the lessons he had. Yeah. He wouldn't be doing the things he did.
He's one of my favourite people in wrestling to hang out with.
And I think
he's great.
He's a joy to be around. He gets the business like almost no one I know.
Mm.
If anyone's listening, they want to learn about wrestling, be his driver for a day. Yeah. Drive him around, hang out with him, listen to him. And it's not too late for him.
Mm.
I want him to get a job in WWE more than I want me to get a job in WWE. And if anyone's listening, I really want a job in WWE. My CV is online at this address. No, but yeah, if him in NXT, he should have a job for life at the top of this business, because once he's done wrestling, he will help the next generation. Mm. And that's genuinely how strongly I feel. And putting aside the fact that I love him to pieces personally, you know, and he's a massive twat. but then he'd be the first to admit it. He's everything. And I think if he doesn't get an opportunity, that's criminal.
Yeah. Matthew, number four.
My number four is the fucking Rainmaker himself, Okada! Yeah, just wanted to do that. I think he's dreadful in the ring. the reason I picked Okada is he is arguably the best wrestler in the world. I you know, I know your feelings on other people, but he's definitely in the top five.
Oh, no doubt.
And I think what's incredible about him is he is in New Japan now. He is the guy in New Japan, but took a very different path to get there than a lot of others. You know, he wasn't called an ace. He wasn't handed the opportunity. He took it and made the most of it. You know, he's been through Shikara, TNA, you know, obviously started at Toramon as well, in the doomed Toramon X class as well. And he's 29 years old and is consistently putting on some of the best main event matches.
Forgetting that he's only 29.
Yeah, he's the same age as me, which is very depressing.
Put it into perspective, Tanahashi is 39 or 40, isn't he?
He's in his early 40s now, yeah. Tanahashi.
So, it's nuts. I'm starting to see a little bit of... So, the influence that Okada got from doing TNA and stuff like that, I'm starting to see in Sanada, who's starting to have amazing matches.
Yeah.
So...
And I think that's what makes him different, is that he's learned so much from such a vast pool of sort of experience. He's not just, you know, 100% Japanese, you know, or strong style or anything like that. He's got elements of everything. You know, he does stuff that's genuinely impressive for a guy his size. And again, he's like WWE have moved their main event sort of style forward. Mm-hmm. So have New Japan over the last years. And one of the main people who have led that is Okada and the style that he does. And I think, again, I know there'll be a lot of people go, well, Kenny Omega, and it's not that I don't appreciate what Kenny Omega is doing, because I again, exactly like the Young Bucks, I genuinely do believe that he is doing something different and is, you know, inspiring people and constantly evolving it. But I think Okada has the body of work, the consistency of being the guy. Like, he's one of the first IWGP heavyweight champions in a long time that you go, well, who's going to beat him? And that's not because Gedo's his mate. It's genuinely, he's the best wrestler in this company. Who is going to beat him? And whoever is the guy, you know, it could be Naito, it could be, you know, it could be a few people. That is going to be super exciting. But I genuinely think he's phenomenal, and he's not even at his peak yet. So,
here's one for you. Do you think we'll see Okada in WWE one day?
Not for a long time. That's my opinion. Because why would he need to go? Because, I mean, Nakamura was different. Nakamura spent 10 plus years maybe being heralded as, you know, he was the new Three Musketeers, him and Shibata and Tanahashi. And I think Nakamura had got to a point where he transitioned from being the sort of MMA guy, or, you know, the guy with the sort of shoot stuff, to being the Nakamura he is now. And I think he had got to a point where he was like, well, he's got nothing left to prove, the same way that Kenta did. And in a way, sort of the same way that Marufuji is in the position as well. So I think not in the near future. And I think that would be a catastrophic loss for New Japan. That he is their guy. He is the face of the new era of New Japan's. Like, who replaces him? And the answer is Naito, but, you know, Naito needs a foil, you know, or someone to work with. So I think I can't see it. Obviously, I don't know, and I'm not even going to pretend like I know, but I think he'll be in that company at the top for a long time.
Good. into our top threes. My number three, remaining in Japan, is Mitsuhiro Misawa. Now, most of my choices have been people that would get by in WWE on their personality as well as their wrestling skill. Misawa, personality-wise, arguably not the best. No. However, the period I would have wanted him in WWE, the mid-90s, when he can wrestle Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Owen Hart and the British Bulldog. and it would have been, maybe Steve Austin, and it would have been the absolute greatest. He's not... See, the thing with Okada's a great wrestler, but also has the personality, and I think speaks English.
Mm-hmm.
Misawa was a fairly sort of slumped over guy who never trained, chain smoked when he wasn't wrestling, and dropped people on their heads.
Yeah.
But there was that aura about him. And, you know, if you could have brought him into WWE in the 80s as Tiger Mask 2,
yeah.
I feuded him with Rollerball Rocco, yeah. which is another one of our choices. So he is... He's arguably the greatest in-ring performer of all time, depending on your viewpoint. Yeah. He's one of my favourite wrestlers of all time. But the reason he's not number one on this list is just, it's down to where would he have fit in with WWE. You could have hired him in the same way that hired Furnace and Lafond.
Yeah.
You know, you could have hired him just because he was a great wrestler. That wasn't the thing. I think for him to have had a successful WWE career would have needed a bit more of a personality. But just in terms of the dream matches I would wanted to have seen, you know, you bring him in for a couple of years and just have him wrestle all those people I mentioned before, they would have all have been tremendous. And, you know, that's why he's my number three.
Good choice.
Number three, Chris.
Number three. Now, this, I believe, is going to be controversial. And I will stand by my choice for reasons that become apparent, because I think I can get away with it. Because he has and hasn't been in WWE.
Oh, God.
My number three is Conan.
Okay.
Right.
Max Moon, mate.
Yeah. But he never appeared on TV. I don't believe he was under contract.
Okay.
So he came in and basically gave the gimmick to Paul Diamond.
Yes.
I
was going to say Brady Boone, but that was Battle Cat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who is my number one? Spoilers. Yeah. Spoilers alert. No, Conan. Max Moon never really happened. I mean, because the only people who know, because he's like a trivia footnote, Max Moon was Conan. But it's, you know, you won't believe. And I don't think I will. I can get away with him now, right? And the reason I say Conan is, anyone who is his only familiar with the shoe-throwing, rolling clothesline guy won't necessarily get... Again, if we go back to that When Worlds Collide event, that in Mexico, if you want a Mexican star, if you want someone who will bring the Hispanic viewers in, Conan was the man in Mexico. He was the absolute man. He was everywhere. He was doing huge business. He was on soap. He had the kind of... the mainstream crossover appeal that most wrestlers would kill for. He was like John Cena back in the day. He was doing all kinds of stuff. He was on the... It's the equivalent of having, you know, Will Ospreay on EastEnders. You know, it's that kind of thing. That was the kind of shows he was in Mexico. And he was a huge, huge star. And then when you look beyond that, if you look back to WCW... he was one of the most over guys on the roster. And people tend to forget that because he was overshadowed. And I think arguably you could say his in-ring stuff was the weakest part. But and because WCW's merchandise machine wasn't much good, and he was often in the NWO, if he'd had like a consistent run of merchandise, you know, him coming out, doing his shtick on the mic, doing all of that stuff, was super over in WCW. And if he had jumped to WWF in, say, 1998 or 1999, he could have been... I think he would have been more believable as a leader of Los Boricuas. You know, he could have been... It would have made for a very, very different thing, because he actually had that kind of... You sort of believed him. I don't know if he genuinely was as gangster as he makes himself out to be, or whether he was less street than I am, but... he carried himself like it, and perception is reality. So considering how he could have been a big Mexican star, and imagining, I think that he's still a bit annoyed that WCW never really got behind him.
Yeah. And he was super over in WCW, and he was massive in Mexico, wasn't he?
And he was also one of my other favourite characters to play in WCW NWO Revenge, because he had the rolling clothesline and that cradle DDT as his finish.
Now, didn't Conan wrestle in WWE as himself, though?
When?
I'm sure he did. I'm going to look it up.
No, I don't believe he ever
did. I seem to remember, you know, before he went Gangster Conan and he had the kind of almost like Roman Centurion.
No, he wrestled in WCW with that gimmick.
Yeah, he was.
That was when he won the US title.
Yeah.
One Man Gang and he wrestled.
Conan El Barbero.
Conan El Barbero.
I think as well with Conan, like the argument you can make is that he again, if we're talking about people that carved out a legacy, him being one of the first, if not the first, the most vocal, person that was in Lucha Libre culture that wanted to break out of that and constantly change what Lucha Libre was. And obviously, you know, everyone knows the story of no Conan, no Rey Mysterio, no Psicosis, no Juventud Guerrera, maybe no Eddie. You know, he was a big part of modernizing Mexican wrestling. And again, even to this day with AAA, AAA is distinctly different. And maybe not for the good, but distinctly different from CMLL. They've got rid of the 2 out of 3 falls rules. You know, their characters are more lavish and over the top. And obviously, again, it'd be interesting. Like, I don't know how much input he had into Lucha Underground, but he had some input into making that happen. So I think that as well as everything you made.
Without Conan, like you said, he was such a big part of bringing AAA guys to ECW, to WCW.
He did have a WWF contract, not as Max Moon.
Did
he?
So Max Moon was 1990 to 91. And then he went back to Mexico, and then he got signed again by WWF in 1992, wrestled 3 matches on Superstars, and then got let go again.
Oh, come on, we've got to let him have it.
Oh, we can have it. I'm just saying, but he was never an extra. He was actually contracted, but then annoyed people and got let go of his contract.
And would LAX have been so successful if it hadn't been for having him in the corner? Because he brought Homicide and initially Apollo and then Machete and then eventually Hernandez in, and they became who they are.
Didn't remember Apollo or Machete.
No, that's what I'm here for.
Who's your number three? Number three.
My number three. So I am staying in Japan, and spoilers, I'm going to be staying in Japan until number one. Number three is Hiroshi Tanahashi, as he likes to be called in his native tongue. He's a Geordie.
Tope con hilo.
Tope con hilo. So Tanahashi, much like Okada, paved the way for a new generation. He kind of reminds me very loosely of Michaels in the 90s.
Yes.
When the ship wasn't necessarily sinking, but it was, you know,
it was listing pretty badly.
It hit a few rocks and it was leaking quite badly. Tanahashi was this breath of fresh air who came in and completely changed the aesthetics of what a New Japan wrestler was, as well as the in-ring sort of style. Like, for a top heavyweight GP heavyweight contender to do a top rope move, it still, in that time period, was so visually different. And I think he is basically a god in Japan. And what is not to like? I mean, he should be on this list basically for the fact of having the greatest hair in professional wrestling. Maybe only second to James Drake, but it's a wonderful Barnett. It is fantastic.
I think, do tweet Jimmy Havoc and ask him this story, but I'm fairly sure that Jimmy Havoc was on a Rev Pro show with him and told him he had great hair. Like that was the only thing he said to him that he kind of sort of put his thumbs up and said yes to. I'll be honest with Tanahashi, he does nothing for me. Like, he's the only sort of top level guy in New Japan that I know he's good.
Yeah.
See, he has what I call Dolph Ziggler syndrome for me, in that I know he's good and I know everything he does is entertaining. I know loads of people love him or dislike him depending on what reaction he's meant to get. But I just kind of go, it's all right. Like, I don't get as excited for Tanahashi matches as I do for as I do for when he was still wrestling Shibata, or for Ishii, or for Okada, or for Naito, or any of LIJ. You know, it's like I don't know why I have the disconnect with him, and I don't know if it's because he feels that his style is 3 or 4 years in the past compared to everyone else at the top of their card at the minute.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. But I think for me, the reason why he makes the list for me was because I didn't watch New Japan very much. The only reason I ever watched New Japan was for the junior heavyweights. I think I've said this before, because I had no interest in heavyweight Japanese wrestling,
sure,
apart from Noah at that time, which was killing it. So Tanahashi, as well as Nakamura, who would definitely be on this list if he wasn't there in WWE now, was one of the guys that made me actually stick around to watch the heavyweights and then appreciate people like Nagata and, you know, Makabe and Kojima and Tenzan and all them guys. Like, it was him for me that, as a younger fan at the time, that made me go, oh, all right. Because it was that time period where they were hard matches to sit through. There was some great stuff, I'm sure, but it was hard for me in terms of my taste to sit through. So I think he really helped make me make that transition from just appreciating the junior heavyweight stuff to the main event stuff as well.
Could you compare him to someone like Sabu in a lot of ways, in the sense that I don't think now people give Sabu quite the respect or attention he deserves, because he was such a big part of a transitional period that he paved the way for other people who've come along since. And it's, without Sabu, we wouldn't have had Rob Van Dam and loads of other people. And without Tanahashi, we arguably wouldn't have Okada, Naito, and lots of other people there. But then there's the problem that he doesn't necessarily stack up next to the people he inspired.
That's, I think, paving the way for Okada and Naito is a really good point. But I think he's more, again, it's probably a lazy comparison, but he's more like John Cena in the sense that he was the young guy that was so different and fresh at the time where he came into that main event picture. Because, you know, when Cena came in and feuded with JBL, I felt like JBL was champion forever, and it was like, you know, and Triple H was on the top and blah, blah, blah. So I think in that sense that he was a guy that just brought fresh blood and then paved sort of the way for everything now. But yeah, I mean, like Tanahashi now, he is the guy that, you know, isn't going to have the cracking matches consistently. Like, I mean, he wrestled Ibushi today in G1, which was a really good match, but it was very much about, like, for me, Kota Ibushi is the new Tanahashi. That he is the new generation of that kind of, you know, dynamic heavyweight. And I think, like I say, it was just that time period when I was getting into New Japan that it was Tanahashi that hooked me in. Because this is before Nakamura was doing the Freddie Mercury stuff, so yeah.
Awesome. Number two for me is Jay Lethal. Purely because, for someone who is as talented as he is and has run several different chapters of his career, so initial indie Jay Lethal, then TNA doing an impression of Macho Man Jay Lethal, to the sort of grizzly veteran Jay Lethal that he is now, I just find it bizarre he's never ended up in WWE. He's been able to do so much stuff, and he's doing what when we talked about Great Muta before and how he adapted himself as he was getting older. I'm sure Jay Lethal's probably still younger than me, but he's adapted as his career's gone on. And I just think he's always been someone who's been able to talk. He's always been someone who's been really, really good in the ring. You think about it, there's not many bad Jay Lethal matches. I can't think of many off the top of my head.
No.
He's always been solid in the ring. He's always had a good look. He's always been able to speak. He's of decent size compared to what most independent wrestlers going into WWE are. And with so many people ending up from TNA or the indies in NXT, I'm just surprised it's never happened.
I could have sworn he was going to be there like in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I mean, we were also lucky enough because he's wrestled a couple of times at Future Shock, and both the matches were incredible. Both the matches made our guys bigger stars. One against Zach Gibson, which is fantastic. One against Cyanide, which when you look at a guy like Cyanide, a 400-pounder, you wouldn't necessarily go, well, that's a dream match. Indy, Jay Lethal, super heavyweight. Fantastic, you know. He's just... and
we nearly had him at a Progress show once. I forget which one it was. And it fell through for some reason. Mm-hmm. But he was nearly on a Progress show. And it...
Do you know what you had in mind for him?
I can't remember off the top of my head. But it would have been great to have seen him in our ring. You know, unlikely to happen now with him being in Ring of Honor. But he's just... And he's someone that I've learned to appreciate.
Mm.
So when I first watched him, and he was at the bottom of the card in Ring of Honor, and doing multi-man matches, and just essentially spot. I didn't appreciate him, and I think it was when he went to TNA. I was just like, he's really good at doing a macho man impression. Oh, hang on a minute, he can wrestle as well. You know, he was in a great tag team with Xavier Wood when he was Consequences Creed as well. It's just.
And he's made the most again. The
Lethal Consequences, one of the best tag team names. Yeah.
Made the most out of the silk purse out of a sow's ear. He's been putting some horrible spots and made the most of them.
And I think that's the sign of someone who can just go. He's always going to get on. Because if you get given a difficult spot and you get yourself over still, then you are winning at wrestling.
I think that's what surprises me most, because he nearly made my list. Like I said earlier on, it was him or Daniels. I think what surprised me most was that TNA run when he was doing the Macho Man stuff. Because it wasn't the character, it was the fact that he had made something that was so eye-rollingly bad, so entertaining, and then got the job done in the ring, that I was so shocked that at no point WWE went, ooh. So it is...
To have that much charisma, I mean, it's one thing being a good wrestler, and this is what I said at the start of this list. If I just chose people that were brilliant, and people will play this game, and they'll tweet it to me, and they will pick workhorses.
Yeah.
That's not necessary. WWE is an entertainment product.
Yeah.
And if you don't like certain things in WWE, then you're not appreciating the bigger picture of what WWE is about, which is an entertainment product. Progress, like, we are an indie wrestling company.
Mm-hmm.
We can do stuff like Keith Lee versus Travis Banks because we want to watch it. Like, we do often put matches together where we're just like, fuck it, we want to watch that. And we know our fans want to watch it because our audience is very different. WWE's audience is a broad entertainment audience. And that's why someone like Jay Lethal is perfect. Because he can wrestle for people like us. And he can do the entertainment side. He can be funny. He can be entertaining. His promos are good. Everything about him is good. And he could do that side of it for the people who are casual watchers who are just flicking through TV on a Monday night in America and go, oh, I like that guy. He's got catchphrases.
But that's the thing with again, well, if we compare Future Shock to Progress, is that we are close to WWE in terms that we've got families, we could be entertaining. So someone like Jay Lethal, who could come and murder it for both of us, but in a slightly different way, again, infinite potential.
Yeah. Who's your number two?
My number two, we're back to moustaches, arguably one of the finest moustache wearers in all of wrestling, Magnum TA.
Oh, what a good choice. Mm-hmm. You mean NWA's Hulk Hogan?
Yeah,
until he wrapped his Porsche around a lamppost.
Yep,
he would have been.
Yeah,
like, the wrestling in the '80s would have played out so differently if Magnum TA hadn't have crashed his car. Also called Terry, wasn't he?
Terry Allen.
Yeah.
Terry
so Allen, all, yeah. The two most important wrestlers in the 1980s, because both have been called Terry.
Terry Allen and Terry Boy. Yeah. The two biggest names.
I thought you were going to say Terry Taylor.
Terry Taylor. Terry Funk.
So
Terry Von Erich.
Yeah, I mean, everyone should go and watch the cage match with him and Tully Blanchard, which is one of the best matches of all time. Magnum TA was because of so much of this stuff wasn't filmed, because it wasn't filmed to the level that stuff was now, and he wasn't a big TV star necessarily. But I think people underestimate how. I wish I'd put him on my list now. He's a great choice. People underestimate how over he was.
Yeah, he was the guy. I mean, when you...
For NWA, he was their biggest babyface. I know people will say, oh, Dusty. Because Dusty had been around for a long time.
Dusty was winding down as Magnum was coming up.
In terms of a new, exciting, mid-80s babyface, Magnum TA was it. And then it took until the end of the 80s, when Sting was hitting his hot streak, to really find someone to replace him. That's how important he was.
Yeah.
If he'd have been fit and healthy, because so many other people jumped from NWA to WWE in that time, there's every chance he could have made the switch.
It would have. I mean, almost inevitably he would have ended up in WWF at some point. Mm. Whether it was during his prime or not, if it, and in fairness, if he'd have taken off the way he could have, it might have been very, very different. He might never have had to go to WWF. It might have been much more even battle. But, I mean, this was a guy, when I first started getting the Bill Apter magazines in the 90s, and the first PWI I bought was 15 years of PWI.
Yeah.
So they went back over who were all the big names and who were there. And I was like, who's Magnum TA? He looks a bit like Jake Roberts and a bit like this guy. And I sort of read up a bit more about him. And all the stuff he did with Nikita Koloff. Uh-huh. So you couldn't get a more 1980s wrestling feud than Magnum TA, the good-looking, all-American guy who looks a bit like Tom Selleck, who... You know, hurrah, dated, etc. You know, ironic, people who like it ironically. You don't remember the fucking 80s, you weren't there. Holy shit, Tom Selleck was God. You know? And he looked the part, he could do everything in the ring, his finish was incredible. Like, his feud with Nikita Koloff. What could be more 80s than Nikita Koloff versus Magnum TA in a best of seven series? It's a TV title, the US title, I can't remember which one, but he was such a huge star, and again, never quite. I mean, this is something that will appear in my top two, what could have been if something hadn't happened.
Yeah.
And yeah, he would have been a big deal.
We should do a top 10 best wrestlers never to win the NWA World Heavyweight title list, because that could be quite fun.
Yeah, you're going on that, yeah. You're on that list.
Delirium.
Yeah, I mean, I had my chance.
In
Wigan.
Who's
2006.
Who's your number two?
My number two is a man that's been mentioned already, and it's Mitsuharu Misawa. Because I think the thing with me was, it's I agree with all the points you made about maybe not having the crossover appeal. But I think the way that I always saw Misawa was I could always see him and like either like Akiyama or Kobashi as a team.
Mm. I think the thing is as well, my point was that I don't think Bret Hart had a ton of charisma.
No.
But he was one of the best wrestlers, so it was fine.
Yeah.
And I think if you're so good, you don't necessarily need all the other stuff. If you're British Bulldog was like, I was been watching old episodes of Raw.
Mm.
British Bulldog was tremendous in the ring. Tremendous. And looked great. You ever heard him do an interview?
Yeah.
Wasn't great. You know, wish to speak ill of the dead or anything like that, but he wasn't great at promos. He never was. He seemed nervous, but it didn't matter because he's got a tremendous body of work.
But charisma isn't just how you talk.
Yeah, loads of charisma just from his
see, that's the thing. Davey Boy Smith carried himself, if we're going to play the game, Mitsuharu Misawa did always look like he was doing a shopping list in his head while he was wrestling. He always had that, did I leave the stove on? That was just him.
Yeah.
And people who say I'll call the Bret Hart thing on charisma, I always thought it was really underrated on the microphone myself.
When I talked about the top heel runs, I think him as a heel in 1997, that was great because it was born out of genuine frustration,
yeah,
and genuine anger,
yeah,
and genuine sort of old man bitterness of, mm-hmm, well, the world's changed and it's left me behind and I'm fucking annoyed, and that was why that worked, I think. When he was trying to be a fiery babyface, he couldn't quite carry it off.
But it's as well, I think it's that thing of, well, what do you class as a successful run in WWE? Because again, it's that thing of like, I think Shinzaki had a successful run in WWE as Hakushi. So he had some great matches with 1-2-3 Kid and Bret Hart, and relatively remembered fondly. You know, so it's that thing of like, I'm not saying that Misawa would have slotted in and been headlining Raw in 1990 against Stone Cold Steve Austin, as amazing as that would be. It's just that thing of like, I would have liked to see what would happen. Because again, like Tenryu turned up in WWF at some point. Yeah. Was he in a Royal Rumble?
He wrestled at WrestleMania as well.
Yeah, that was it.
Demolition. Yeah.
That was it. It was at Mania. So it's that thing of like, I would have been it's my intrigue on this one more than my, oh, this what is the path you would go down and this is what you would do.
Okay. Right, we're up to our number ones. But I didn't realise you had an upstairs.
We don't. There's a flat upstairs, and I believe what they generally do is throw sandbags around.
Socially, seems it.
It's Shockmaster.
Yeah, okay.
He's trying to come through the wall.
I've met his son.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. He works for WWE's live events team. Talk about his son.
Oh.
He's lovely.
Is he called Dingy?
Hey!
Nice. Still no Poisson. My number one should be of no surprise to anyone who's ever listened to this podcast, because he's my favourite wrestler of all time. That's Kenta Kobashi.
Never heard of him.
Now, he's nearly always my favourite wrestler of all time. So every day is slightly different. So the reasons for having him are as follows. He's had all the best matches ever. That's a pretty good reason. One of the matches I've mentioned, one of my favourite ever matches, is him and Kikuchi against Crawford and Furnace, which, you know, Crawford and Furnace were a great team. They were in WWE. They didn't have a load of charisma. But in that match, they looked like monsters because Kobashi and Kikuchi make them look like monsters. Mm. Tons of great matches with Misawa. Great runs in All Japan. Great runs in Noah. 23 Wrestling Observer 5-star matches, which is the second highest of all time. 25 is from Misawa. But the reason I've chosen him is he could do it in an American way as well. Because he had one of my favourite matches of all time in 2005 against Samoa Joe in Ring of Honor. Now, the way I would use Kobashi in WWE, because he was quite a big dude for a Japanese wrestler,
yeah.
The way I would have used him would be as a sort of, not he wouldn't necessarily need to be super heel or anything like that, but just someone who came in and possibly had someone talking for him on account of him being Japanese and English not being brilliant, but someone who just came in and killed people.
Yeah.
Because in the mid-noughties, you could have hired him, you know, at late 30s, early 40s, you could have hired him feasibly. Just imagine him in 2000, around sort of 2003, 2004, 2005 WWE, when they had all the workhorses going.
Yeah.
Imagine just putting him in and going, Mr. Kobashi, do you want to wrestle Kurt Angle? Fuck yes. Just having him in at that point and having him have great matches, have a mouthpiece so he's got a bit of a persona, in the same way that they give people to Paul Heyman who can't talk. Yeah. You know, but just have him come in and kill people, because there is no more convincing killer of wrestlers than Kenta Kobashi, I don't think. And it would be weird if I didn't pick my favourite wrestler of all time on this list, considering he's never been in WWE. So that's my number one, to no surprise to anyone listening. Who's your number one, Chris?
I think I referenced it about the what might have been thing.
Mm.
So my number one is Bruiser Brody.
Which is a good choice, because I want to be able to say Huss quite a lot.
Yeah, he didn't like being told what to do.
No. I mean, if there's one understatement of the year, it's Bruiser Brody didn't like being told what to do.
No, so he burnt a lot of bridges on his way around, but to the point where if you're a draw and you're talented, people will forgive you more than if you're dog shit, as a rule.
Watch him and Stan Hansen versus the Funks from 1984.
Nice.
It is...
Ooh, lordy.
Oh, it's violent.
It's
all the violence.
All of the violence.
Oh, yeah.
But he was one of those guys who was utterly believable. Mm. Again, larger than life. And so good that they actually did a parody of him in WWF, didn't they? With Berserker was very much like a watered down version of
and the Blue Brothers,
yeah. And you know it's
and Jimmy Jacobs in Ring of Honor,
Huss. and Kenny Omega. Oh well, I'm just thinking about curly hair now, really, aren't I? It's just, but he's
hardest man in the world called Frank.
Yeah.
Frank Butcher was pretty hard, wasn't he?
No, mate, get out.
Oh, okay.
What about Frank West? Punisher?
Nah, still not as hard as Bruiser Brody.
And his brother makes tuna. But it's the whole thing with Bruiser Brody is he imagine him coming in like in the 80s. He'd have been arguably one of those guys that worked with Hogan on top if he'd have been wanted to. But, you know, he's...
Well, it's a bit difficult to make him work on top because there was every chance he'd just kill the person he was working with.
Yeah, but then it's also, I don't think he'd hit the peak of what he could do.
Mm.
And I suspect, like, you'll notice that a lot of these nut bars in pro wrestling do mellow a little bit as they get older and they realise that, okay, everyone hates me, no one's paying me anymore, maybe it's time to just, you know, learn to count to 10 occasionally. Mm. And it could well have happened for him. That whole never say never. Like, that, if you know, if I had a pound for every time someone showed up in WWF or E and people said it never happened, I'd have enough to cover my subscription for a couple of months at least.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have surprised me. Obviously, I mean, it's a well-known story that, that Invader one stabbed him.
Yeah.
Mm. In Puerto Rico, and that's a horrible state of affairs. Mm-hmm. If that hadn't happened, what would the future have held for him?
Matthew, round us out with the list. Who is your number one? Who? You've been really hipster-free so far.
My number one is the great Muta.
Thought you were quiet earlier.
Yeah, right. So it's that thing of again, it's about possibilities. And, you know, he held the NWA World Heavyweight title for, what, a couple of days or whatever it was. But he was there, you know, he had TV title, maybe.
TV title for a bit, yep.
Yeah. You know, former IWGP Heavyweight Champion, former Triple Crown Champion. And like you said, he had a crossover appeal because for that moment in the NWA and WCW, he was a believable threat.
Sorry, I wasn't applauding, it was a fly.
Oh, good.
Okay. I thought you were trying to turn the lights on.
I know, yeah.
Can't run out of batteries.
But yeah, like, he was a believable threat. Like, he didn't look out of place in there with Sting and Ric Flair and everyone else. So for me, it would have been interesting to see if he did stick around, because that sort of, you know, that sort of gimmick was always a constant in America. You know, there's the great Kabuki and then the previously mentioned Hakushi and all that sort of, oh, he's a mysterious Japanese man with face paint. So it would have been really interesting because he's a guy that had charisma as well as, you know, in-ring work. I mean, I know there'll probably be people that would be like, oh, well, when he was knocking around with Vampiro, it wasn't exactly, you know, knocking it out of the park. And I was like, well, yeah, fair point. But, you know, yeah. I think he's got a stellar body of work. And, like, the point that Chris made was his constant evolution and the fact that he kept on reinventing himself, you know, reminds, you know, us of Sting and The Undertaker.
He's very much the Madonna of Japanese wrestling, isn't he? Was it the Ray of Light era or?
Yeah. No, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know anything about Madonna.
Frozen.
That's the only.
I know Madonna's Madonna's boyfriend, who was a wrestler,
Louis Piccoli.
Yeah.
I don't know if he actually was a boyfriend.
What?
I'm not saying he wasn't, but I don't know.
But yeah, the point being that, like, Muta had the potential to be a big star as well as just being in the mix with it. But again, like, I think we've pretty much touched on everything. But I think, again, for me, he's just that guy that could have been the one, you know, the one Japanese guy that could have been in the main event picture. But hey, you know, hindsight's 2020. And
I mean, if we think about it, if he had, instead of going back to Japan, gone to WWF in 1990 and worked with the Ultimate Warrior, and then work with the guys who were around there at the time, then transitioned to working with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, and that would have been exciting.
Yeah, no, too right. Well, good lists, guys. We don't have loads of crossover. I know last when we did the top 10 matches, we had quite a bit of crossover. Yeah. So,
there's loads of wrestlers.
Yeah, there's loads of matches.
But there's more wrestlers than matches.
No, there isn't.
No, I thought that. I thought this.
Think
list,
about what you've just said. Yeah. There's obviously more matches than
this
wrestlers.
List was
you
well
guys
harder.
Are the best. I love our chats.
Quickly, Matthew, you on Twitter is
M Richards host.
Sending pictures of bread. He loves that.
Yeah.
Or just pictures of people crying. Christopher Brooker, you are on Twitter.
I am. I am at the Brooker Man.
Yeah.
Send me pictures of Jet from Gladiators. She tweeted me the other week, and my life has been downhill ever since.
I am at Jim Smallman on Twitter. Obviously, listen to everything on the Distraction Pieces Network. Check out jimsmallman.com/TNJ for live podcast tickets for September the 9th. And to point people in the general direction of this podcast. And also progresswrestling.com, demand-progress.com for progress wrestling stuff. The only show you can buy tickets for is in New York. So I hope you've got a boat. We will see you next week with some more wrestling
chat. Thanks for listening. Send us your list as well at Jim Smallman. Use hashtag ChoosingNigel. All right, ta-ra!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.